Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about the fast food strike that went on all across the country and what's going to happen in the days to come. Also, unemployment news coming out, because understand, at the end of the year, the Republicans in the House, the House, the Senate, I think, wants to pass a farm bill and wants to pass an unemployment extension and wants to do the things that need to be done. I think it's the recalcitrant House, the Republican-led House. But here at the end of the year, unemployment, the emergency unemployment, done. We're talking a couple million people who are going to be kicked off the program. And let's not forget about the farm bill. The SNAP money that they want to gut, $40 billion, literally taking food out of the mouths of children. We're going to talk about that. Also, Alex having their big, the American Legislative Exchange Council, having their big meeting in Washington, D.C. to figure out how they're going to divvy up and destroy the nation. Well, today I'm going to talk about how they're working to destroy and kill renewable energy and all of the work to get off the juice that's been done in the last several years. Also, a sad day. The death of Nelson Mandela. We'll talk a little bit about that. Also going to take your calls, your thoughts, your questions, comments. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Along with the big news there, I came across this. It just stopped me in my tracks today. While you've got thousands of people out in the streets protesting and striking and saying, we want a decent living wage for working people. We want to be able to have some dignity and respect. We want to be able to have that access to that American dream, that middle class. I came across a story about, when you think about the middle class, when you think about Americana, when you think about, the image of the middle class, you think of Norman Rockwell, don't you? You think of the pictures that he painted. You think of that time period when that was, that's what the middle class was about. That's what that path was. Well, it turns out three of his paintings, three of them, sold for almost $60 million. And I'm going, I gotta be honest. This just really, to me, signifies what's happened to the middle class. That image of the middle class is being, auctioned off to the people at the very, very top. Not even just the 1%. Because the 1% can't afford that. We're talking the 1/100th of, or the 1/1000th of the 1%. Those handful. The people that you could probably fit in a pretty big room. Those are the people who would pay Sotheby's $46.8 million for the Saving Grace picture that shows an elderly woman and boy bowing their heads together. You may remember that in prayer at a restaurant. You remember that? Also, the Breaking Home Ties one. Sold for, I guess back in 2006, $15.4 million. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, this really is, I think, the death of the middle class. I mean, I think this is it. It's done. Unless we do what folks did today, which is get out in the streets. Now, yesterday you may have seen the story that President Obama had gone out and given a pretty good account of what he plans to do in the next couple of years, and it's to address this inequality. And what he said was, and I think he hit the right note when he said, growth alone doesn't guarantee higher incomes and wages. And the third part of this middle-class economics is empowering workers. And that's what I think we were seeing today. People who are saying, we've had enough, we've taken enough, and now we're going to go to the streets and we're going to fight. And we're not going to allow the CEO class to continue its massive theft from the working class. I saw this, again, you see a lot of data, but EPI had an interesting graph on the disparity between CEO pay and the typical worker. Not the minimum wage worker, not the low wage worker, but just your average worker. 273 to 1. So for every hour that the CEO works, you'd have to work 273 hours to make what he takes home in just 1 hour. And if you take that wealth disparity between the top 1% and the median household, that number jumps to 288 to 1. So, look, the reality is, I agree with Obama. Inequality is the challenge of our time. Inequality is what is tearing this country apart. And, you know, I've seen so many stories, and I've had a bunch of people email me, and thank you for the correspondence. I've enjoyed the back and forth, especially with my conservative friends who have bought into this line that, well, you know, they're just kids, because that's all they hear. That's what fake news on Fox says. That's what all the mainstream media keeps pointing to. But we know that's not reality. We know that's not reality. And the other canard is, oh, it's going to cost us. We'll lose jobs. They'll ship jobs out overseas. Or, like we talked about last night, they'll mechanize. They'll mechanize everything. You'll punch your order into your iPhone. And we all know that they're doing that anyway. I go to a restaurant, and I go there still because the waitresses know me and no longer push the little computer thing on the table at me. But the first time they brought it to me, said, well, we want you to order on this, and we want you to pay your bill on this. I said, if you're making me do this will be the last time I'll be here. And I think we need to be pushing back against that stuff and pushing back hard. But I believe the president is right. We need an economy that's going to ensure workers have a voice, have an opportunity to make a decent wage, have access to health care, have access to a reasonable retirement. And for me, they're very, and I'm glad he's on board again. I'm glad he's found the faith again, if you will. I'm so happy to hear it. Because there are policies we should be pursuing. There are things we should be talking about to start pushing the agenda. Instead of reducing Social Security, instead of chain CPI, we should be expanding Social Security. And how are we going to do that? But Rick, we're broke. Social Security doesn't have any money. Social Security is fine. Thank you very much. Going to pay out benefits for the next 75 years at least three quarters of the amount, and then on infinitum at that, at three quarters of the rate. Now, if we tweak it a little bit, it's fine for as far as the eye can see. To me, that tweak is, if I'm paying the Social Security tax on 100% of my income, so should everybody else. It's that simple. So should everybody else. And to me, you take the cap off, and this is something I've been advocating for 8 years now on this program, saying that it's ridiculous that there's this imposed cap that every working class person in this country pays on 100% of what they earn, but the guy who sits in the corner office, well, only up to $110,000, and then if you make your money gambling on Wall Street, you don't pay anything? Really? I'm of the mindset income is income, you pay tax on it. It's that simple. Now, as I see this, give people dignified retirement. Don't steal their pensions. And, you know, with all of the pensions that are being stolen from people, we need that expanded Social Security. We should have people who have the ability to negotiate for better wages, hours, conditions, a stronger labor law that's going to give people the right to organize. We need to strengthen our social safety net. Strengthen our unemployment insurance. Do a lot of this stuff. And the big one, and I think, you know, this is where I give Obama a little bit of credit. Healthcare. Healthcare is a huge thing. That decides whether you're ever going to be anywhere near the middle class. Because I've said for years, the only way you're in the middle class in this country is if you've got some health security. If you get sick or one of your kids gets sick, you don't end up in bankruptcy. It's pretty simple to me. And going back to the decent wage, we need a minimum wage at least half of the median wage. At least half. Because that's what it was supposed to be. That was the barest minimum to get by. In fact, we should have a minimum wage that is above the poverty line. You shouldn't work 40 hours a week and be in poverty. I'm sorry, it just should not happen. Now, on the minimum wage front, Paul Krugman recently asked the question in one of his articles. Can we really help workers simply by legislating a higher minimum wage? He says, doesn't that violate the law of supply and demand? Won't the market gods smite us with their invisible hand? And he says, well, the answer is that we have a lot of evidence on what happens when you raise the minimum wage. And the evidence is overwhelmingly positive. He said, hiking the minimum wage has little or no adverse effect on employment while significantly increasing workers' earnings. And what does that mean? That means they're buying stuff. So as you saw the news today, and finally the mainstream media is picking up on that, you know what? There are workers who are striking, and they want better wages. They want decent conditions. And you hear people say, well, $15 an hour seems like an awful lot for minimum wage. I don't think it is. Because had minimum wage kept up with productivity gains, the minimum wage in this country would be over $21 an hour. And you think about it, productivity is more than doubled since 1968. Had the minimum wage kept pace with just from 1968 forward, had it kept $21.72 an hour. Now, had the minimum wage grown at the same rate that the folks at the very top, the top 1%, have seen their earnings grow, the minimum wage would be at $22.62, a 212% increase. So what you've got is you've got the corporate profits who've soared. And you go, how did corporate profits soar? Oh, yeah. We're paying 7.25 instead of 21.75. Gee, I wonder where all those profits came from. Huh. Now, what you've got is you've got all these people, all these fast food workers are going, you know, we're making minimum wage or a little bit above, because, you know, one study from the UC Berkeley Labor Center said the average wage of a fast food worker is about $8.69 an hour. About $8.69, and a bump up to $10 would help millions of these workers. It's estimated that 87% of all the fast food workers have no health care. So think about that. Now, compare that to the CEO, the McDonald's CEO who pocketed a 237% increase in his pay, in his compensation from the year before, pocketed $13.8 million last year, up from $4.1 million. Sorry, we don't have money for you. Nonsense. They got tons of money. It's just that they've chosen to give it to their executives and their shareholders. Now, how does the fast food industry, how do they survive? How do they make huge profits? You and me, American taxpayers. The National Employment Law Project put out a study not too long ago, and we talked to them a couple of times. McDonald's alone costs we, the taxpayers, $1.2 billion each and every single year in public assistance. That's Medicaid, it's food stamps, it's LIHEAP. Why? Low-wage business model. Now, look at it this way. We subsidized $1.2 billion to McDonald's. McDonald's made $1.5 billion last quarter alone. So telling me that they can't afford it is ludicrous. The top 10 largest fast food companies in the country cost we, the taxpayers, nearly $4 billion in health and Medicaid and health assistance alone, $1.04 billion in food assistance, $7 billion overall the fast food industry cost. These 10 companies cost us each and every year. Now, those top 10 companies, profits of $7.4 billion last year. And they paid out $7.7 billion in dividends. So you're looking at, well, you're looking at $15 billion that they made in profit, and we gave them $7 billion? And they're saying, well, we can't afford to pay our workers. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. Now, what you've got is a situation where people are saying, we've had enough. And I'm glad to see it. It's about time. And we come back, we're going to talk to one of the strikers from Pittsburgh today who was out in the streets, you know, why he was out and what's going to happen from going forward. We're going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois will cut state worker retiree benefits, raise the retirement age for some public workers, and in some cases cut cost of living adjustments. Unions call it theft and are taking it to court because the Illinois Constitution bans diminishing or impairing state worker pensions. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said political attacks on workers' hard-earned pensions are unconscionable. She says the bill should be vetoed by Governor Pat Quinn. Weingarten says the pensions bill in the legislature would rob working people of their life savings. Workers will get less in retirement while the state saves $90 to $100 billion over 3 decades. For years, politicians in Illinois shortchanged public worker pension systems by failing to put enough money in. The Illinois House earlier had refused to allow a vote on a union-backed plan to reform the pension system, even though it had passed the Illinois Senate. As the American Legislative Exchange Council met in Washington, D.C., some members of Congress sounded the alarm about the pro-corporate anti-public interest agenda of ALEC. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan says ALEC is arguably the most effective lobbying organization in the country, and in his opinion is violating IRS rules on political lobbying by 501(c) groups. While ALEC lawyers are trying to form a new front group to get around IRS political lobbying rules, Representative Pocan says ALEC continues to attack the public interest in a variety of ways.
From voter ID laws to pension law changes to going after public workers to the Stand Your Ground law and many, many other bills we've seen across the states. When they're introduced in a number of places, it's from this conservative organization, this lobbying firm that's called ALEC. It is definitely not in the public interest. It's in the special interests who fund the organization, and we need to do everything we can to stop their activities.
A new report from the Center for Effective Government says lower taxes on corporations does not produce more jobs. The report says the 30 corporations that paid the highest effective tax rates added 200,000 jobs to the U.S. economy during the past 5 years, while the 30 corporations with the lowest tax rates cut 50,000 jobs during the same period. American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox says this report could fundamentally change the shape of the budget debate in Washington. Cox says America faces a jobs crisis, not a budget crisis. AFG is calling for more revenues to prevent job cuts and to provide needed services. In 2012, U.S. corporations reported earning nearly $1.8 trillion in profits. If they had paid a 35% tax rate, revenue would have been $630 billion. But they paid a much lower average of 12.6% effective tax rate instead, yielding just $242 billion in revenue. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, I'm looking at this. You're talking about over $15 billion in profit the top 10 fast food companies took in last year. The $7.4 billion they pocketed and the $7.7 in dividends they handed out to shareholders and the Wall Street crowd, really. And then you go, well, you can, if you've got $15 billion in surplus, you can pay your workers a little bit more, right? I don't think the taxpayers should be having to subsidize the top 10 fast food companies with $7 billion in tax subsidies through Medicaid, through food stamps, through heating assistance, through school lunch programs, and all of the safety net programs that we have for the poor. I don't understand how it is that we can justify setting up low-wage business models that working people have to go and ask for help. It's ludicrous. It's nonsensical, but it's what we've allowed to happen. And I'm telling you, I am so grateful to see people out in the streets. And one of those folks out in the streets today was Marcus Scott. He's a striker from Pittsburgh, works at Dunkin' Donuts, one of the first places that went on strike at 6 a.m. this morning. So I'm sure Marcus is tired. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
So one of the frames that we hear, and all of the fast food workers and all of the retail workers I've talked to over the last several months, None of them have been pimply-faced teenagers. The frame that I keep seeing, Marcus, coming at me from my conservative friends is that, well, we have a minimum wage so people can get an entry-level job. Those teenagers can learn to show up on time and learn what it's like to have their first job. So my question is, how many of your coworkers are pimply-faced teenagers?
I have, they're out of a total of about 20 workers, there are only 3 to 4 underage workers there.
And the rest of the folks?
The rest of the folks are 18 and older. A lot of them have families that they have to help provide for. Some of them have children, parents that are unable to work. And then we also have a few people who are old enough to receive pensions, but they have to keep working to supply for their families as well.
That's the face of a low-wage worker, just what you laid out. And that's been my experience as I've talked to folks time and time again. You know, the frame that we hear from the anti raise the minimum wage people or the anti-living wage people, is that, well, you know, those are just low. They'll mechanize all of those jobs, and those people will lose their jobs, even though we know raising the minimum wage is not going to do what they say it's done, because it hasn't in the past.
Right.
So what made you get out in the streets today? Explain the organizing that took you to this point. What is it that got you involved in this?
I really just felt that that we aren't respected as the people who deal with the consumers firsthand. Our customer service skills are put to work firsthand. Our hard work is firsthand there in front of the customers. We do a lot of the hard work, and it really made me see that we aren't respected at the workplace. I have a family I have to provide for.
Right.
And that was really pretty much my motivation to come out today.
And how many of your coworkers were with you?
Besides myself, there were about 6 others.
Wow. So you had a pretty good turnout. You know, when I look at this, and I've been calling for the last couple of years for this kind of organizing to begin, to where low-wage workers say, you know what, there's only so much of you-know-what I'm willing to eat, and now I'm full. So as we look across the country, we see thousands of people doing this, not just in the fast food industry, but also in the retail industry and in other service sectors. This, I think, is a good start to begin to, you know, the push towards a living wage. What kind of response did you get from people that you encountered on the streets? What kind of response are you getting from folks as they learn about what you're doing?
For the most part, we had a very supportive response from the community, passersby. A lot of people supported what we were doing today. I've only met, I believe, out of maybe about a few hundred people that, you know, get given some type of response to us, whether it be them driving past and honking or, you know, screaming out of their cars as people stop out of the bus and the trolley to holler out to give us their support. There was only 2 people who said $15 is too much, and the one gentleman was elderly. And I met another gentleman who said that he was making $20 to $30 an hour in the 70s. So he believes that that's a fair wage as well.
Yeah, I mean, I tell the story, you know, back in the mid-80s, I was making $15 an hour throwing boxes on a shipping dock. They don't make that today. And what we've seen a walking backwards of decent family sustaining wages. We've seen a decline and really the destruction of a middle class wage. And I'm of the mindset, Marcus, that there's no job that's being done where you shouldn't have the dignity to be able to put food on your table, put a roof over your head. I don't think there's a job in this country that shouldn't be above the poverty line, so that what you're making, what you're producing, you should be able to consume.
Right.
So I look at the fast food industry, and you look at the 10 big companies, because, you know, we keep hearing this frame, Marcus, that, well, this is really an attack on the mom and pops. And I got to be honest, I don't know any mom and pop fast food chains. I know huge multinational corporations like McDonald's and Yum Brands and the rest of them. But the top 10 companies in the fast food industry employ about 2.2 million people. And you think about, you know, us giving those 10 companies $7 billion in taxpayer subsidies while they're pocketing well over, you know, $20, $30 billion. I think they can afford it.
Yes, I believe that they can. I just don't think that the corporate America don't want the lining in their pockets to lessen.
There you go. So now, is the call that you're asking for a raise in your wages, the ability to organize and to join and form unions collectively, is it for a legislative aim? What's your goal here?
Our goal is to absolutely. I believe that a legislative aim would be the most powerful. I believe that that would have an impact not only just in our city, but all across the whole nation. You know, there are a lot of people who would be relieved of their financial stress if they were able to get a base minimum wage above the poverty line.
You know, I look at that, and you think about all of the money that we subsidize for these low-wage industries, the Walmarts and the McDonald's and these big, huge, extremely profitable multinational corporations, and all of the tax dollars that we give them. If we were to set up and I'm a big fan of people joining and forming unions. At the workplace, you fight for the profits that you produce and the work that you produce, that you should be able to share in that. I don't know that I'm not a legislative angle is one way, but I'm a big fan of people getting together and fighting and demanding better conditions. But you look at these huge, big, these massive companies who are lining their pockets and the pockets of Wall Street at the expense of not just you and your other fast food workers, but me and other taxpayers as well. So I think it's about time that just from a broad, even if you're nowhere near affected by minimum wage, supporting a massive increase in the minimum wage, it's good for taxpayers, in my view.
Correct.
Because we then say, you know what, you're going to cover your own health care, you're going to cover your own pension, you're going to cover your own food subsidies, all of that stuff. And, you know, I don't know if you saw the story, but last week Walmart, it came out that Walmart was actually taking up food collections for their employees.
Well, that in my opinion, is degrading to a degree. I don't feel that they should have to do a food drive. They can easily afford to give them $50, $100, $200 gift cards for them to shop at their own workplace.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So let me ask you a last line of questioning. Now that you've taken this step, where do you go from here? Where do you see this this moving on forward?
I see a lot of other people who are frustrated, who've seen us stand up today for our rights, for better rates, for better wages. I believe that they will be intolerant to employers keeping them down with, you know, poverty pay. I believe that they'll start standing up more and more often in other places that not only are just fast food, but like you said, retail and in other industries as well, that they'll, you know, stand up and fight against, you know, the powers that are holding them back.
Yeah. You know, I see what you're doing as an incredible message for empowering others to get involved and empowering others to say, you know what, I've had enough and I'm not taking it anymore. And I congratulate you for that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Marcus Scott, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks for what you're doing. Appreciate it. I wish you nothing but the best of luck.
Okay, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, Marcus Scott. I'll take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but know they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
In 1972, I was part of a nationwide campaign that came close to getting the U.S. Senate to reject Earl Butz, Richard Nixon's choice for Secretary of Agriculture. A coalition of grassroots farmers, consumers, and public interest organizations teamed up with progressive senators to undertake the almost impossible challenge of defeating the cabinet nominee. The 51-44 Senate vote was so close because we were able to expose Butz as, well, as Bud Ugly. We brought the abusive power of corporate agribusiness into the public consciousness for the first time. We had won a moral victory, but it turned out to be a curse and a blessing. First, the curse. Butz had risen to prominence in the world of agriculture by devoting himself to the corporate takeover of the global food economy. He openly promoted the preeminence of middlemen food manufacturers over family farmers. "Agriculture is no longer a way of life," he barked. "It's a business." He instructed farmers to get big or get out, and proceeded to shove tens of thousands of them out by promoting an export-based, corporate-run food economy. "Adapt," he warned, "or die." "The ruination of farms and rural communities," Butz added, "releases people to do something useful in our society." This is Jim Hijar saying, the curse of Butz, however, spun off a blessing. Small farmers and food artisans practically threw up at the resulting Twinkieization of America's food. They were sickened that nature's own contribution to human culture was being turned into another plasticized product of corporate profiteers. They threw themselves into creating and sustaining a viable alternative, linking locally with consumers, environmentalists, community activists, marketers, and others. The Good Food Rebellion has since sprouted, spread, and blossomed from coast to coast. To find farmers markets and other expressions of this movement right where you live, go to localharvest.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
No, don't worry. He'll be back. He'll bring his toxic ideas back in 2016. Relax. We'll see Rick Perry again. You know it's coming. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts on increasing the minimum wage? Good idea, bad idea? I'm curious. I think I've heard just about every argument against it. I think the argument that it's going to cost us jobs is ridiculous because... Yeah, I think we all have this view that, well, minimum wage workers work for mom and pop. And that's not true. In fact, they say more than two-thirds of low-wage workers are employed by companies with 100 or more employees. I don't know that anyone could look at McDonald's and go, oh, yeah, them and their 700,000 employees, they're a small business. I don't know that you can look at Yum Brands, which is Pizza Hut and Taco Bell and KFC, with their nearly 400,000 employees and say, that's a small business. I don't know that you can do that. And I don't know that you can look at Walmart or any of the big box, the Targets or the Kmarts or any of the big box retailers and say, you know, you're a small business. I don't know that you can do that. So the argument that, well, it's going to hurt small businesses, well, ludicrous on its face. And we've already debunked the pimply-faced teenager. That's not reality. We've already debunked they'll just mechanize because they're doing it anyway. Hastening the minimum wage, increasing the minimum wage is not going to hasten it any faster because it's already happening. You know, they've got people delivering packages for $8-9 an hour, I've seen. 10 in some places. Amazon wants drones. So when these capitalists, when these very wealthy people figure it out, there'll be nothing for any of us. And when you frame it in that light, that look, they want to make human beings redundant. They want us buying their stuff. They want us consuming their stuff. But you go work for somebody else. I want all my profits for myself. And we've been hearing this ever since the Pope brought up the idolatry of money, ever since he brought up the inequality and the greed and all of it, he started talking about this. You've seen the wealth class in this country really go into hyperdrive. You know, they've got the Limbaughs and the all of them all tingly in the panties and all wadded up going insane. They've got their message machine pumping out constantly that, oh, you know, it's capitalism's the greatest thing in the history of worlds, the greatest thing since sliced bread. And there's an argument to be made that, yeah, people acting in their own self-interest does at some point create wealth for individuals. But is it good for the society as a whole when you get down to the end of the road? It's like anything. On paper, everything works perfectly. When I was coaching football, now that I coach basketball, every play scores. Everyone. Everybody does exactly what they're supposed to do, and everybody's where they're supposed to be in the play, and everything's perfect. You know, models and on paper, everything is perfect. But in the real world, what ends up happening is you end up having where we're at now. You have a system that's top-heavy, and the bottom can no longer support the top. When you have the accumulation of wealth that we have right now, that is not good for society. So when people say, well, you're talking about redistribution of wealth, I go, yes. I'm in favor of redistributing wealth back to the people who created it. I mean, at some point, don't you then go, you know, I would like to see workers have better wages so that they can put money back into the economy. Wouldn't you like to see people say, you know, if we have a strong, burgeoning middle class, that's good for business, too. Just kind of a thought. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I see Bill's on line one. How are you doing tonight, Bill?
Good, Rick. How are you?
I am fantastic. What's on your mind?
Well, you wanted a call on the as far as the minimum wage and all. What I'd like to say is this. When I started working, I believe my minimum wage at that time, which is what I earned, was about $2 an hour.
So you're talking about the middle 70s.
That was actually earlier than that. This was in another state, but it was a little earlier than that. But at any rate, my rent was $60 a month. Gas was about 35 cents a gallon. I never had any kind of utility bill much more than $12, $15. The phone, I don't think, was more than $8 a month. I don't even remember what food was, but it was cheap. And I, of course, got a little overtime here and there, and I do remember always having money for the weekends to go have some fun. The other thing that really sticks out in my head, and I try to explain this to people, you know how this health care issue has become such a big thing nowadays? Well,
yeah.
Way back then, I remember, because it was funny, too, it was real easy to get a job. If you went to work someplace and didn't like it, you'd quit and find another job the next day. I mean, literally, that's what it was like.
Yep.
And health care was like a given. You worked 30 days. Usually, maybe 2 months at the most, you got your Blue Cross, Blue Shield, whatever it was. No big deal. It wasn't even considered a benefit. And then the other thing that really stands out in my mind, I don't remember anybody's mother, when I was, you know, still a kid, having to work. Nobody's mother worked. It was unheard of. It would be like a slap in the face to the man. So anybody that thinks that, you know, minimum wage now should be about $20 an hour.
Yep.
To keep up with what the cost of living is. So, you know, I don't know how you correct it. I mean, a huge part of the problem, of course, is the executives and everything taking so much of the profits. But, you know, I guess other parts of it are all the lawsuits and this and that. I mean, there's a lot of factors.
Well, do you think, Bill, that the loss of workers having a voice and being able to organize, I mean, we've seen union density in this country down from when you were working for minimum wage, somewhere around 28-29%, down to about 7% in the private sector. So the ability for workers to demand higher wages, not just for union members who got, you know, contracts, but for their non-union counterparts who benefited from those contracts by having companies who raised wages up to similar rates so that they wouldn't.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And as a matter of fact, most of the jobs I had, you know, when I was a kid, I mean, none of them were good jobs. I worked my way up into, I finally got a pretty decent job with this one guy I had worked for, which I started out as minimum wage. But, the thing that was, you know, just in general, you got a lot more respect on the job. You weren't taken for granted like you are nowadays. I mean, there's really an attitude of, well, there's the door. You don't like it, you know?
Yeah,
that isn't the way it used to be.
Yeah, you're just a number now.
Exactly. And what kills me, I mean, you mentioned people like Limbaugh and all these characters. What gets me is people, let's put it this way. If you're over 50 or 60 or, you know, in that age bracket up there or older, you sure as hell ought to be able to remember what I'm talking about. But yet that particular group who's already pretty well got what they need, you know, they seem to have forgotten where they came from, where their parents came from, and I don't know what the hell they think it's going to become of their kids if things don't change.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
You know?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And, you know, because that's part of the things I talk about here on the program is because I do remember some of that stuff. I do remember talking to people who, when I was a kid, I had the opportunity to talk to a lot of people who their working lives were during the Great Depression. I think the problem is we've gotten so far away from those hard times that it's hard to imagine that they ever existed. And you know,
well,
even as bad as 2008 was, it still wasn't 1930.
No, but, you know, here's part of the other problem, too. And of course, you know, you mentioned the unions, but it goes beyond that. Really, much more so today than I think at any other point in history, and at least in our country, it's really every man for himself, you know. And basically, if I got mine, screw you, that's your problem, you know. And I don't get that. I mean, there was a hell of a lot more you know, consideration and concern for, you know, your fellow guy in the trenches there, you know. It's amazing to me how much we've changed and how little we remember.
Now, how do we turn that around then, Bill? Any ideas?
Well, education is, you know, really the key to the whole thing, but, you know, you can't be one or two people with a voice in the wilderness. I've been talking this way for years, and, you know, I seem to turn a few gears when I get on my rants, but, you know, I think there's an awful lot more, you know, you, people like you and me and what have you that need to get out there and speak up and kind of bring people down to reality a little bit, you know, because I don't see any future if things don't change. I really don't see any future at all.
Yeah. Do you buy
that? I've got a son. Huh?
Yeah. Go ahead. You got a son?
Yeah. I mean, I got a son. You got kids. You know, I mean, I'm really worried. I've been worried since the time he was little, and you know, except for the fact that I've got some stuff, money and stuff put away for him, I really wonder sometimes where he'd be, you know, down the road if he wasn't getting help from us and the poor kids who really are you know, out there. I mean, I know a number of them myself, and they got all this education and everything. That's another thing, how the colleges, I think, really sold them a bill of good.
Yep.
Because, you know, go with $80,000, $100,000 in the debt, and, oh, well, there's no jobs out there, but, you know, you got a good education. I mean, come on.
No, I mean, in the perfect example, I go back to myself. I learned to drive a truck by having a job. And the union promoted the company training people to drive a truck. Now you've got kids pay $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 to learn how to drive a truck. You look at, you know, people learning to do construction. They're going to school to learn to swing a hammer, where the building trades have been running a paid apprenticeship programs for generations. But it's all about how can we extract money out of those kids? Because they want that middle class.
Part of the problem there, though, too, is I think, Rick, and I'm a big believer in unions. I mean, I've belong to several of them for my working career. But part of the problem, I think, too, is they don't speak up enough. I mean, I don't think a lot of people really are aware of how good, well, not even how good, how, the fact that those kind of programs even exist. I mean, I've told people, why don't you, you know, even get the pipe fitters or you know, carpenters or whatever. I mean, sure, you might have to travel and this or that, but you're going to have a good trade and you're going to be able to go, you know, damn near anywhere and support yourself.
No, I think you're right. I think more advertising does need to be done.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, they're in the public eye, but they're always in the public eye for the wrong reasons, I think. You know, get out there and let people really know what a good alternative you can offer, especially the youth, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And, you know, with all the with this now crummy transportation bill, that's still $2 billion of investment. There's going to be jobs for the next several years. Now's the time to be getting into this, because the apprenticeship programs are going to be growing. And you know, you've hit on something, and I think I'm going to, at the beginning of next year, going to spend a lot of time courting those guys to come talk about their apprenticeship programs.
Oh, that would be excellent. That would be excellent. I mean, I know. Some years back, before I got the last job I held, I'm now retired, but the last job I held before that, I knew a number of iron workers, and I had known a lot of them from this other, from a nuclear power plant where I worked, and you know, I was in between jobs, and a couple of them were saying to me, well, you know, you can join us, you know, we'd love to have you, blah blah blah, and I'll tell you what, I wasn't a young guy. And they said, even in my case, you know, and I must have been around 50 at the time, you know, they said, no, we, you know, and they told me different jobs in the Iron Workers Union and, you know, Brownsman or whatever the heck it was called. But I mean, you know, even things like your age doesn't necessarily preclude you from starting a whole new career in a valuable trade.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. And I'm going to do that. I've done it a number of times in the past, and I should be doing more of it. I appreciate the thoughts. I appreciate the call.
Sure.
Please call back
my
anytime.
My pleasure.
It was great talking.
Thanks,
with
Rick.
You.
Bye-bye.
Let's take a quick break. Back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor is constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Can't do that. Can't surrender. Got to take to the streets. And, you know, like we talked with Marcus earlier, I'm proud of the folks who are willing to stand up and say, you know what, enough is enough. I'm going to come out of the shadows and stand up and say no more. You know, the reality is, you know, $7.25 for an hour of your life, that's pathetic. And I mean, if you would have just thought about just keeping up with inflation, as Bill was talking about, you know, back when he was working for minimum wage, had the minimum wage from his time just kept up with inflation, not with productivity, not with the top 1%, just inflation. The minimum wage would be $10.55 an hour right now. And you would be able to be above the poverty line. I mean, that just seems illogical to me. Anyway, let's go to the phone line. It's got Jeremy on line two. How are you doing tonight, Jeremy?
Hey, Rick.
What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to call and tell you, I'm a 32-year-old male, and I've worked most of my life from the age of 15, and at the current rate, I make just slightly less than, say, $17 an hour, so not even really what we want to consider a livable wage. Out of that money, when the bills are all paid, and I have some extra things, like a couple things like TV, a cell phone, I don't have any money left to save. Yep. So I essentially don't have any savings, and I do not see retirement in my time, honestly, ever coming.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm a little bit older than you are, and most of the people of my generation are in the exact same boat because we've seen the destruction of decent wages in this country as we've deindustrialized and our trade policies have killed us.
Yeah, and they're squeezing us more and more all the time for the nickel here and dime there. Thankfully, in my case, because of the Affordable Care Act, I now have health insurance.
What? Hold on. Somebody who's not opposed to the Affordable Care Act? Someone who doesn't hate Obamacare?
I disagree with some of what Obama's done, yes. Like the Patriot Act, some other things.
Well, Obama, hold on. Let me back you up on that. That was Bush. That was 2001. Obama wasn't even...
He re-signed it, though.
Yeah, he did. But, I mean, that ship has sailed. The country
right.
has pretty much given up. There's a lot of things I blame him for. That one I kind of give him a pass on.
Well, I guess you're right in that case. I just wish he hadn't re-signed it. But anyway, yes, I am totally for Obamacare. I believe that everyone should have health care. I don't think it's a choice. I think it's a human right.
There you go.
I don't understand the mindset of if you can't afford to pay for your medical care, well, we're just going to put you in and let you die.
But didn't
I've
you,
never
didn't,
understood that.
Didn't you hear Mitt Romney when he was running for president? We're not going to let you sit in your hotel room and have a heart attack or in your apartment. We'll come get you. We'll give you care. Didn't you hear him?
Yeah, he said you could go to the hospital and get a $50,000 bill and go to work the next day. That's what he basically said.
Yeah, well, they have to treat you just long enough that you won't die at that moment, and then they will hound you till the day you die or until you file bankruptcy.
Well, they won't, but they'll sell your debt off, and you'll have some creepy guys call up and throw it in a book at you. And in some states, as my understanding from talking to some other people, there are debtor prisons coming back in those states, and they can put you away for a bill.
Yep.
Fortunately, in Vermont, they can hand you all they want, bring it to court, and all they can tack on to you is a $35 court filing fee on top of your debt. And then you tell the judge what you can pay. He'll come to Palisade and you pay that, and that's too bad on them.
That's one of the things. There are a lot of things I like about Vermont. In fact, you know, you're one of the states that actually had the rest of the nation followed your governor's lead and your legislature's lead in setting up your marketplace. And I think we would be a lot better off with getting folks health insurance in this country.
Yeah, we've had a rough go of things. I mean, I was very saddened, like I think a lot of us with the same mindset was when Fox, ABC, CBS really pounded Dean for the woohoo comment when he was excited.
Yeah.
Wow, big deal. I mean, it's not like he's insane. He's a very smart man. He did a lot of good things for this state. Fortunately, we sent someone, Bernie Sanders, to the representative's house, so he's there putting the smack down when he can.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Bernie. In fact, the first guy I interviewed when I started this program 8 years ago was Congressman Bernie Sanders at the time.
Yeah, he's a real nice guy. I mean, he's down to earth. He's about the working guy. I know a lot of people who oppose who he is. They still respect him because he tells them who he is and doesn't try to hide it.
Yeah.
But at the same point, they'll try to smear him and say that he's taken, he's been bought out, he's just another one of those states, and he isn't. He really isn't. I mean, that filibuster he gave earlier this year, which was like for 12 hours, was pretty amazing. He's an older gentleman.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a governor here in my hometown for 20 years before he went on to the Senate.
So you're from Burlington then?
I am from Burlington, and he was mayor here for, yeah, I want to say, 15, 20 years.
Beautiful, beautiful place. Spent a lot of time up in that area. In fact, when my wife and I ran away to get married, we ran away to Waterbury, Vermont, and got married right there at the one bed and breakfast by the Ben and Jerry's. But that's a whole other story of nobody really wants to know. So let me ask you, before I have to take a break, so back to this minimum wage thing. What do you think the right number is? Because I've heard a lot of people say $15 an hour is too much. I don't think it is. I'm curious what your thought is.
I think minimum wage, realistically, is more like should be $23 an hour mandatory.
There you go.
Because that gets you, you know, it gets you your minimum things, plus a little bit more if you want to save. I mean, like I said, I have a few extras, and I could go without them. But to have some quality of life, I still have them. And when it's all said and done, I have dollars left between paychecks and nothing in the bank. So if anything big ever comes up, I'm screwed the wall 10 times over.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate
including car repairs.
Yeah, heaven forbid something catastrophic happen. Jeremy,
exactly.
I appreciate the call, man. Call back anytime. It was really good talking with you.
Sure, no problem, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. And to bring up, you know, Australia. Australia's minimum wage is $16.88 an hour. And you got the billionaire, Gina Reinhart, who's the hardest day's work she ever did was making it through the birth canal. She wanted to knock it back to $2 an hour. The wealth class there, not much different than ours. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK.
Own 90% of the wealth, 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth, where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself, 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Illinois will cut state worker retiree benefits, raise the retirement age for some public workers, and in some cases cut cost of living adjustments. Unions call it theft and are taking it to court because the Illinois Constitution bans diminishing or impairing state worker pensions. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said political attacks on workers' hard-earned pensions are unconscionable. She says the bill should be vetoed by Governor Pat Quinn. Weingarten says the pensions bill in the legislature would rob working people of their life savings. Workers will get less in retirement while the state saves $90 to $100 billion over 3 decades. For years, politicians in Illinois shortchanged public worker pension systems by failing to put enough money in. The Illinois House earlier had refused to allow a vote on a union-backed plan to reform the pension system, even though it had passed the Illinois Senate. As the American Legislative Exchange Council met in Washington, D.C., some members of Congress sounded the alarm about the pro-corporate anti-public interest agenda of ALEC. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan says ALEC is arguably the most effective lobbying organization in the country, and in his opinion is violating IRS rules on political lobbying by 501(c) groups. While ALEC lawyers are trying to form a new front group to get around IRS political lobbying rules, Representative Pocan says ALEC continues to attack the public interest in a variety of ways.
From voter ID laws to pension law changes to going after public workers to the Stand Your Ground law and many, many other bills we've seen across the states when they're introduced in a number of places. It's from this conservative organization, this lobbying firm that's called ALEC. It is definitely not in the public interest. It's in the special interests who fund the organization, and we need to do everything we can to stop their activities.
A new report from the Center for Effective Government says lower taxes on corporations does not produce more jobs. The report says the 30 corporations that paid the highest effective tax rates added 200,000 jobs to the U.S. economy during the past 5 years, while the 30 corporations with the lowest tax rates cut 50,000 jobs during the same period. American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox says this report could fundamentally change the shape of the budget debate in Washington. Cox says America faces a jobs crisis, not a budget crisis. AFG is calling for more revenues to prevent job cuts and to provide needed services. In 2012, U.S. corporations reported earning nearly $1.8 trillion in profits. If they had paid a 35% tax rate, revenue would have been $630 billion. But they paid a much lower average of 12.6% effective tax rate instead, yielding just $242 billion in revenue. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new Constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Money free.
Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So over the summer, we had taken the People's Tour for America. And in fact, over the Christmas holiday, we're going to be replaying the entire tour. You may remember back in June, we went all across the country discovering labor history and, well, you know, presenting it to my kids because, you know, our history, not very well taught to our children. So what we did is we went across country and we discovered, all of us together, our history and the things that I think are important for my kids. Because, you know, I go back to my daughter was taught about Rosa Parks. And she came home and said, Dad, you know, Rosa Parks did this. And I go, well, why do you think she did it? Well, she was tired. It was just a spontaneous thing in her mind. And part of my doing the tour, and I hope you'll tune in from December 17th on until the end of the year, is to show, you know what, there's an awful lot more than just she was tired. Which is why when I saw this book, Defining the Struggle, National Organizing for Racial Justice, 1880 to 1815, I said, you know what, I got to talk to this woman, the woman who wrote this book, because, you know, the civil rights movement didn't just happen in the 60s. It was a long, long process. So I've got Susan Carl. She's a professor at the American University Washington College of Law, where she teaches legal ethics, anti-discrimination law, labor and employment law, and also torts. She's the author of Defining the Struggle. Susan, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I go back to our tour over the summer, and you know, I think of the Rosa Parks incident, or I think about Martin Luther King being in Memphis. You know, most people just think he was there to give a speech. He was there to support striking workers. Rosa Parks, you know, she sat down on the seat on the bus after months of training at the Highlander Center. And I go, you know, we're taught history in very distinct moments. And all of the organizing and all of the thing that goes into it, we don't seem to get.
That's right. I think that's very true. It's hard to tell a complicated story, at least at the first time through. But it's important to understand what the roots of the sort of big events that we remember, where are the roots of that, and where is the energy that people gave to create that moment. And I think the Rosa Parks example is a really good example. because that kind of refusing to move in response to a Jim Crow law, refusing to go to the back of the bus or the back of the train or the back of the streetcar, that had been going on since the 1880s, even the 1870s and before. So there are lots of cases like that, and she wasn't the first one by any means to refuse to move when asked to because of a law that violated the dignitary rights of people on the basis of race.
Yeah, because, you know, and I talk to a lot of my friends because I go to a lot of labor protests, and when the Patriot Coal thing was going on, we went to a bunch of those events where people were being arrested all the time, and they're going, why are they getting arrested? I go, because you've got to get these cases into the courts so that decisions are made that this is how you build, this is how you move forward, or am I missing, or do you think I'm off base here?
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I actually have a little bit of a background as a community organizer in central Pennsylvania, so I'm really enjoying hearing your story about your tour and thinking about labor history. And there are also, you know, many intersections between labor history and civil rights history.
It's a struggle. Yeah. I mean, it's the constant fight for equality and social justice and economic justice.
Exactly, and that's something else I think that oversimplified story of the civil rights movement just describes the civil rights movement as being about formal equality under the law. But really the civil rights movement, and you touched on it when you talked about Martin Luther King being in Memphis to support the striking garbage workers there, the civil rights movement has always been concerned about economic justice and social justice in a general way, as well as working on issues that were specific to civil rights and law and formal equality.
So you go through a pretty in-depth history of all of the different organizations and a whole bunch of names that I got to be honest, you know, as someone who likes to think that I know a little bit about history, there were names that came up and organizations that came up in the civil rights movement that I had never heard of. And, you know, I mean, we've all heard of Booker Washington and some of those names, but there were a bunch of folks that I guess history's forgotten.
Exactly. And that's really why I wrote the book, because I thought it was important to try to remember more of the heroes from this very early period that have sort of gotten pushed aside or aren't part of the narrative because of bigger events that happened later. But I thought it was important to talk about people like Reverdy Ransom, who is a minister in a AME church, a bishop in the AME church, and who founded a lot of organizations that were really important, or T. Thomas Fortune, who thought up the idea for what ended up being the NAACP a couple of decades before the NAACP got going, or Mary Church Terrell, who founded the National Association of Colored Women, which was a reform organization that was very, very active. So I wanted to just sort of, you know, bring up those names again and talk about the importance of these early contributions to what happened later.
How much of this story, because, you know, as I was talking with some friends about it, you know, you're bringing up the Civil War and all the bad history. I'm curious if you've had any response back of, well, you're just digging up dredging up some of the old stories.
No, I really haven't had that response at all. I've had people, you know, at least before they heard the story, before they heard me talk about the book, I have had some of my colleagues, for example, have said, why are you doing something relevant? Why are you writing about something that happened so long ago? But I'm writing about it asking questions that are relevant today.
Yeah, I think it's
so
absolutely
really
relevant. Just the fact of organizing. I mean, you know, today we saw fast food workers all across this country out in the street doing the basic organizing that, you know, based, you know, almost the same thing. In my
Absolutely,
view.
yes. And one of the points, I think, one of the lessons that I wanted to bring out of the book, or it's really a lesson that I learned in writing the book, was that you never know today which of the various kinds of strategies and campaigns going on today are going to be really important later. Just as the activists that I'm writing about, they were experimenting on a whole lot of different fronts to try and figure out what might work, what might stick, what might actually make some change. And I think, you know, talking about things like the fast food worker strikes today, you know, that's not the traditional way that labor law envisions strikes happening and that kind of thing. But this might be the next big thing. This might be really important. So it's just so important to keep being an activist.
And talk
in
about
whatever situation.
Yeah, and talk about how social movements begin, and because I can, you know, in looking at the book, you know, there were a number of different ideas on which directions. You had a couple of conservative ideas of, you know, maybe we shouldn't be militant, or, you know, a bunch of push and pull within the movement at the start, as I understand it.
Yes, absolutely, and I think we see that repeated over and over again in various social movements where you have the more radical or militant wing. And it really creates room for the moderates to come in, and then they can negotiate with whatever the power structure is, because as compared to the radicals, they seem very reasonable. And so you see that happening at this period, too, where the more militant voices are creating room for others, like Booker T. Washington, who's very moderate or conservative. And he's the white power structure likes him because he seems much more less threatening than Du Bois and the other radicals who are demanding civil rights equality right now. So, yes, you definitely see that dynamic going on.
Yeah, you know, and today's the day that Nelson Mandela passed on.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the quotes that I've always thought of and that have been attributed to him is, you know, something seems impossible until it's done. And, you know, I look at your book and I look at the civil rights movement, and you go back, you know, imagining at this time when you're writing about, it seems impossible that you would have the right to vote, you'd have access to, you know, just the number of things that we have today. It would seem almost unfathomable.
Yes, it did to the activists that I'm writing about. And there's one passage where Du Bois is saying in the Crisis magazine in around 1912 or something like that, he said, you know, it's going to take another 200 years for us to have civil rights equality. And of course, it didn't take quite that long. And the idea, if he had actually envisioned that in 100 years there would be an African-American president, I think he would really have been, you know, blown away by that idea. So you don't know what will happen. And I don't mean that to say that everything's fixed now, but just to say that history is always surprising.
Yeah, and to me, I enjoy the stories of organizing and seeing how things and pieces move together. So, you know, I haven't finished it. I'm working through it, but I think it's a good tale of how organizing and how movements begin.
Yes, and you're right to pick up on that. I'm a law professor, and I was really writing about the way that law, how people thought about law, but because I started my life as a community organizer, I'm as interested in the organizing strategy part as I am in the law part. And I'm really interested in how the two things fit together.
Is there anything
with
your community organizing background and your labor background and your law background and all that, anything in your research that surprised you that said, wow, that grabbed you?
Yeah, a lot of things surprised me. And it was what made this project really just so interesting to work on. It took me a long time to finish. Some things surprised me in a good way, but other things surprised me in a bad way. And I hope you don't mind me telling this part of the story, but one of the things that surprised me was just how awfully racist a large portion of the labor movement around the turn of the century was. You know, Samuel Gompers, really, by the time he really seized control over the AFL, he really was a very prejudiced person.
But in his defense, if I can make a very weak...
I knew I would push a nerve. Yeah.
No, it's not. You're not pushing a nerve because you're telling
okay.
the truth. But
yeah.
Wasn't that the nation? I mean, it's one thing to say it's, you know, it's
yeah.
them, it's the labor leaders, but it was the entire nation. We're not just talking about one guy.
Yes, it was the entire nation, and you're right to say that some people... it was most of the nation, but there were some very visionary people, white, who were civil rights activists, religious people, and some labor leaders who were very much opposed to racism and understood the importance of unifying people across race. And so it wasn't everybody.
Right.
But it was the leadership, and the activists that I'm writing about were very... the militants, the radicals, had a sort of a class-based analysis, and they were very much wanting to work with the labor movement. And the labor movement really rebuffed them over and over again. And I think that's another sort of historical moment where civil rights and labor got separated as two different ideas or two different kinds of paths or sets of goals. but they didn't really have to be that way. And it really was the fault of not all whites, but many whites. And it's something I think we still need to really think about and care about today, is mending that, you know, that harm that was done historically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at New York, and, you know, I drove a truck for a living for a number of years, and, you know, going into New York City as a truck driver is an absolute nightmare. And it's because, you know, going back to Henry Hudson, this is how the story was told to me. Factually, I'm not 100% sure. But, you know, they claimed he was a racist and built all of the bridges at 10 feet, so that the buses couldn't get out of New York, because you wanted to keep those people in the city and didn't want them spreading out and coming out of the city. So you basically, at the time, you couldn't get out.
Yeah, so there are a lot of examples like that. That's a good one. It's built right into the infrastructure of the city now.
Yeah. And, but, you know, I look at this, and again, the book is Defining the Struggle, National Organizing for Racial Justice, 1880 to 1915. We've got a link. How you can get it over at Powell Books. I'll make sure that you click on Susan's name. It'll take you there. Last question I've got for you in looking back at this. You know, the struggle is not over, right?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's still very much alive. And in many ways, you know, we got a lot of work to do, because there's been this backsliding with the court, and, you know, a lot more to do.
Well, I'm with you, and I appreciate the time. I appreciate the book. And when we finish our book for the People's Tour for America, I will make sure that you're one of the folks I send a copy to.
Oh, wonderful. I would really like that.
All right. Susan Carl, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
This holiday season, try buying a gift that can really make a difference in someone else's life. Buy your friend, family member, or coworker a goat and help fight hunger in South Sudan. To do so, visit goatsfortheoldgoat.com. There you can buy a goat and also shop for beautiful merchandise made by actual women from South Sudan. One click of a button this holiday season could mean the difference between nourishment and hunger for people who often go days without eating. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
In 1972, I was part of a nationwide campaign that came close to getting the U.S. Senate to reject Earl Butz, Richard Nixon's choice for Secretary of Agriculture. A coalition of grassroots farmers, consumers, and public interest organizations teamed up with progressive senators to undertake the almost impossible challenge of defeating the cabinet nominee. The 51-44 Senate vote was so close because we were able to expose Butz as Butt Ugly. We brought the abusive power of corporate agribusiness into the public consciousness for the first time. We had won a moral victory, but it turned out to be a curse and a blessing. First, the curse. Butz had risen to prominence in the world of agriculture by devoting himself to the corporate takeover of the global food economy. He openly promoted the preeminence of middlemen food manufacturers over family farmers. "Agriculture is no longer a way of life," he barked. "It's a business." He instructed farmers to get big or get out, and proceeded to shove tens of thousands of them out by promoting an export-based, corporate-run food economy. "Adapt," he warned, "or die." "The ruination of farms and rural communities," Butz added, "releases people to do something useful in our society." This is Jim Hightower saying, the curse of Butz, however, spun off a blessing. Small farmers and food artisans practically threw up at the resulting Twinkieization of America's food. They were sickened that nature's own contribution to human culture was being turned into another plasticized product of corporate profiteers. They threw themselves into creating and sustaining a viable alternative, linking locally with consumers, environmentalists, community activists, marketers, and others. The Good Food Rebellion has since sprouted, spread, and blossomed from coast to coast. To find farmers markets and other expressions of this movement right where you live, go to localharvest.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The horn. The walls came down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Got an email during the break, and you can email me too, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Drew the Geek sent me, and it's well, how he addressed himself, sent me an email saying every business wants to make money. The more money they have to spend to do business, the more likely that they're going to raise the cost of their products or services. From the way he sees it, the purpose of raising the minimum wage is to put more money in the pockets of the American people so they can afford the basic cost of living. It seems to him that it would be better to reduce income tax and personal property tax. That should put more money into the pockets of your average American. It says, in fact, if you really wanted to put more money into the pockets of the average American, reduce fuel cost, offset the cost of oil so that it will cost less for people to put gas in their car. He says when it costs someone $40 or more to get to work, that can add up. He claims that Bush once randomly, and the key of that sentence, randomly, dumped a bunch of barrels of oil into the market, causing the cost to drop dramatically. It hurt oil investors, and he warned that if they didn't keep the cost of oil reasonable, he'd do it again. And he says, I feel that the real solution is to reduce the cost of living instead of giving people more money. And, you know, there's an argument to be had there. The problem is, let's go with the first thing, reduce income tax and personal property tax. Start with the income tax. The folks who are out in the streets right now, all of the fast food workers, all of the retail workers, those folks are the 47% that Mitt Romney mocked. Those are the 47% of people who don't pay federal income tax because they don't make enough money to pay federal income tax. In fact, we have this thing. Thanks to Ronald Reagan, and I give Reagan credit when he deserves it, that he took a very conservative Milton Friedman idea of a negative tax, turned it into the earned income tax credit, and actually, if you're in that low wage, we actually subsidize that more when you file your taxes. We actually give you more money than you paid in to try and boost consumption. At the time, Reagan called it one of the best pieces of legislation ever to come out of the Congress, one of the best pro-jobs pieces of legislation, pro-family. So the idea that we're going to lower taxes anymore for working people, not really likely. Personal property taxes, we can make an argument, but who's going to pay school taxes? Who's going to pay for the things that we need? Who's going to pay for infrastructure? I would argue, you go back to the good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower, good Republican socialist. The top marginal tax rate was 92%, and folks at the bottom were paying 20%. So those 47% of the people who are paying nothing today, and in fact getting some money back, they were paying 20% in taxes. So this idea that, oh, we're taxed so heavily, and we just can't make it because, oh, we're so taxed. Nonsense. You go back to the golden era of the Norman Rockwell painting, $60 million. You go back to that era, taxes were considerably higher. We were investing heavily in infrastructure, in the space program, and all these things that created jobs. And I know I've heard the nonsense, government doesn't create jobs, private sector creates jobs. No, but government creates demand. See, we used to know this. As for the Bush canard of he dumped a bunch of oil barrels into the market. He, during the election, and I remember this vividly, in 2004, during the heart of the election, he did open up some of the strategic oil reserves, about 3.2 million barrels. Now understand, in this country, 3.2 million barrels is about 4 hours of our national consumption. I don't quite understand how that amount is going to drastically reduce the price. And, in fact, it didn't really reduce the price drastically. It was a little bit. Now, should we be having a conversation on oil prices? Should we be having a conversation on energy? Absolutely. But my view, Drew, pretty simply this. During the times, and I use the good socialist years of Dwight David Eisenhower, where workers, 35% of them were in unions, which meant 35% of their non-union counterparts were making at or similar wages with health care benefits and retirement. So you had 70% of the people making decent wages. You had a large middle class. You had an industrial sector that was growing. Because we didn't have insane trade deals that said, you know what, GE, go ahead, make your stuff in China and ship it back here. Yeah, go on, General Motors, go to Brazil, go to China, go to Vietnam, go wherever. We didn't say, go ahead, Nike, go over to Vietnam and make all of your shoes and all of your products in Vietnam and ship them right back in here. We didn't have those kind of idiotic trade policies. We actually had trade policies that benefited us. That we said, we're going to negotiate for our workers. That's when we cared about the nation. Now we care about profit. Now we care about the next quarter. How much is the stock price today? How many newspapers have a business page that tracks the day-to-day, the Dow's up, the S&P 500? How many newspapers in the country have a business page? All of them. How many newspapers in the country have a labor page? None of them. How many of them have a labor reporter? There's one, I think. One national newspaper, one big newspaper that has it. It's the New York Times. So when I look at this and I hear these very right-wing arguments, well, we just need low taxes. Taxes haven't been lower since the end of World War II. Have not been lower. I don't think they've been lower in the last 100 years than they are right now. And we've had an income tax for 100 years. So this canard that they keep throwing at us, this ridiculous, we just need lower taxes, how much lower can they go? When you have the 30 lowest paying tax corporations in the Fortune 500 who have shed jobs over the last decade. And I guess going back to that, you know, this is one of those things that catches my attention. There was a study done, and I talked about this yesterday for a bit, a study by the Center for Effective Government. And they pointed out that the 30 Fortune 500 companies that paid the highest tax rates between 2008 and 2010 actually created nearly 200,000 jobs. On the flip side of that, the 30 companies that paid the lowest tax rate actually fired more than 51,000 workers during that time frame. And you look at this and you go, there's a fundamental misunderstanding on what the tax code is there to do. I've said before, look, you go back to the Eisenhower years, you go, okay, there is a top marginal tax rate of 92%. Did the wealth class of that era pay 92%? Hell no. They paid anywhere close to that. What they did is there were loopholes, lots of them, lots of loopholes, lots of incentives. We incentivized everything. Build libraries? Incentive. Build hospitals? Incentive. Invest in philanthropy? Incentive. We made the wealth class of that era invest right here. Not take their money overseas, not find loopholes to get out of the country to the Caymans or to Switzerland or Bermuda or Panama or wherever else, or the Isle of Jersey. We said, you invest your money right here and we won't tax you at such a high rate. And they did. So this, to wrap it up, this idea that, oh, all we got to do is cut taxes. Sorry, Drew. Not buying it. But I appreciate the email. Thanks so much. Anybody else wants to email me? Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Appreciate it. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Homeless or the poor. Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game? From the master of the cloak and dagger.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois will cut state worker retiree benefits, raise the retirement age for some public workers, and in some cases cut cost of living adjustments. Unions call it theft and are taking it to court because the Illinois Constitution bans diminishing or impairing state worker pensions. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said political attacks on workers' hard-earned pensions are unconscionable. She says the bill should be vetoed by Governor Pat Quinn. Weingarten says the pensions bill in the legislature would rob working people of their life savings. Workers will get less in retirement while the state saves $90 to $100 billion over 3 decades. For years, politicians in Illinois shortchanged public worker pension systems by failing to put enough money in. The Illinois House earlier had refused to allow a vote on a union-backed plan to reform the pension system, even though it had passed the Illinois Senate. As the American Legislative Exchange Council met in Washington, D.C., some members of Congress sounded the alarm about the pro-corporate anti-public interest agenda of ALEC. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan says ALEC is arguably the most effective lobbying organization in the country, and in his opinion is violating IRS rules on political lobbying by 501(c) groups. While ALEC lawyers are trying to form a new front group to get around IRS political lobbying rules, Representative Pocan says ALEC continues to attack the public interest in a variety of ways.
From voter ID laws to pension law changes to going after public workers to the Stand Your Ground law and many, many other bills we've seen across the states. When they're introduced in a number of places, it's from this conservative organization, this lobbying firm that's called ALEC. It is definitely not in the public interest. It's in the special interests who fund the organization, and we need to do everything we can to stop their activities.
A new report from the Center for Effective Government says lower taxes on corporations does not produce more jobs. The report says the 30 corporations that paid the highest effective tax rates added 200,000 jobs to the U.S. economy during the past 5 years, while the 30 corporations with the lowest tax rates cut 50,000 jobs during the same period. American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox says this report could fundamentally change the shape of the budget debate in Washington. Cox says America faces a jobs crisis, not a budget crisis. AFG is calling for more revenues to prevent job cuts and to provide needed services. In 2012, U.S. corporations reported earning nearly $1.8 trillion in profits. If they had paid a 35% tax rate, revenue would have been $630 billion. But they paid a much lower average of 12.6% effective tax rate instead, yielding just $242 billion in revenue. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Mr. President, do you see a major difference between the two of you on Social Security?
You know, I suspect that on Social Security, we've got a somewhat similar position. Social Security is structurally sound. It's going to have to be tweaked the way it was by Ronald Reagan and Democratic Speaker Tip O'Neill. The basic structure is sound.
Tweaked, is it? Tweaked. We just need to tweak it. That's all. Just like Reagan and Tip O'Neill did. As I remember the tweaking was the largest tax increase in the history of the nation when they set up the you pay 6.6 and we'll pay 6.6, have a big, big pot of money that over the years, you know, they were happy to dip their hands in. But now the answer is, well, we're not going to do that. We're just going to cut people's benefits. And it seems to be almost bipartisan, which is why I look at the Republicans calling for it. You got a number of Democrats falling for it. It's ridiculous, but it's what the moneyed interests want. And here to talk a little bit about it, I've got Matt Wall, he's press secretary over at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Matt, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So you got this group of people. You got the Fix the Debt people. You got the Third Way people. You got all these folks with deep, deep pockets saying the only way we can fix Social Security is to cut the benefit, raise the age, and basically make it less accessible and, well, less amount of money.
Yeah, it's pretty outrageous. You got a lot of people who have ties to Wall Street, have a lot of money, who think that we don't need Social Security anymore because they're totally disconnected from working America and, you know, the needs of working people. They don't understand that, you know, our seniors on Social Security, a lot of of them, it's their only income, and they're barely scraping by. And, you know, that's kind of why the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Harkin in Iowa, Gerard Brown, Senator Schaaf in Hawaii are calling on Congress to expand Social Security, because right now it's not enough. So, you know, those corporate titans and Wall Street billionaires who want to cut Social Security, their heads are just either in the clouds or they just don't care.
Oh, I think it's they don't get it at all. When you look at places like Detroit, where they're now going to be stealing people's pensions, you look at Illinois, where they're taking away cost of living, and as I understand, maybe being able to retroactively change some of the amounts. Here in Pennsylvania, eventually the pensions of state workers are going to be on the menu, as the Republicans begin to attack that. I gotta say, Social Security is gonna be the last opportunity for workers to have any opportunity to retire, because we've seen the pension structure in this country absolutely diminished and destroyed since 1982 with the invention of these crummy 401ks and all of these Wall Street schemes to steal it.
Oh, absolutely. It used to be that Social Security wasn't a retirement plan. It was just, you know, supposed to be there to catch people who fell through the cracks. But more and more folks are falling through the cracks because, as you said, the pensions are being slashed by corporations. The stock market, you know, is doing whatever it wants with people's 401ks. We saw in 2008 people lose, you know, their life savings on the stock market. And then, you know, Social Security is the only thing left. It used to be a three-legged stool, and now we're on one and a half legs, if that. So that's why, you know, it's more important than ever to increase the benefits that our seniors and others are getting, because it's really the only thing left making sure they don't fall further and further into poverty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but they make an argument that we're going to save Social Security. This is how the only way we can save it is by, well, raising the retirement age, because, you know, people are living longer, and the only way we can save it is by cutting the benefit. And they go, well, then I got to be honest, what's the point? I mean, if there really is a problem, and do you admit that there's a problem with Social Security? Do you think there is? Because I got to be honest, I don't.
No, I don't think there is a. I mean, if there's a problem with Social Security, it's that it's not giving seniors enough benefits right now. It's not indexed to inflation to meet the medical needs, the increasing costs that they face that other folks, when you know. Calculate inflation, don't have those set costs. So if we're looking at Social Security, it's they're not giving enough benefits, but the trust fund is sound, it's paid for years to come, and, you know, we can easily make it so we can pay for more benefits and increase the solvency, it's solvent, but increase the solvency simply by raising the cap on the taxes that people pay in.
There you go.
You know?
Yep.
No. It's simple. It's simple math, and you know, someone paying, earning $50,000 a year is going to pay into Social Security on every single dollar that they make. And Senator Harkin talks about this a lot. He says, you know, if you're making $500,000 a year, you're only going to pay 20 cents on every dollar that you make. You know, you're only going to be done paying Social Security around April. Whereas a working person making $50,000 a year is going to have to pay in Social Security all year long.
How
come
we don't?
Not fair.
How come we don't hear that narrative enough? I mean, I got to be honest. You know, we hear the frame. Oh, and you hear it a lot. We're broke. The system's broken. You've heard the frame, and I've had a number of people say, especially younger people say, I'll see a UFO before I'll see a Social Security check, which is ludicrous. But it's what we've been sold. It's what the media has pumped into our ears.
Yeah, you know, I don't know when it became so prevalent to talk about it, but I know I've seen reports saying that more and more young folks, like myself, I'm a young guy, aren't so pessimistic about Social Security. And, you know, it's one of those things where it was a narrative for a long time. I think a lot of Democrats bought into it, but, you know, you saw it this spring, you saw it over the summer, Democrats are really starting to grow a backbone and fight back on this. You saw when Representative Grayson and Representative Tucano started their letter pushing back against chain CPI when we had that quote-unquote fiscal cliff that they invented. And then, you know, over the summer you had Senator Harkin from the purple state, the early primary state of Iowa, and Mark Begich from the red state of Alaska put forward this plan to expand Social Security. You know, I think Democrats are now going on offense. I think the conversation is shifting, but we need to make sure the message gets out, because I think there are still a lot of folks, both in Congress and, as you mentioned, in the media, that are still, you know, pushing this canard that we're in trouble and kids aren't going to see Social Security checks because magic.
Right. No, I mean, you know, and the argument that I make to people younger than me is, you know, you're probably not going to get a pension. The defined benefit pension has pretty much been eviscerated. It's pretty much been just destroyed from the landscape of the American workforce. So you're going to be left with this crummy 401k, which, if the statistics that we see now are going to continue, especially with low wages, the average 401k, the number I saw was about $18,000 across the employment spectrum. That's not enough to retire on. So Social Security, if I'm 20, 25, I'm going, maybe that's my only chance to retire. Maybe by making sure that there's a strong anti-poverty program in place like Social Security, maybe I got a shot.
Exactly. And, you know, this movement to protect Social Security, to expand Social Security, as I mentioned, it's really growing momentum. You can see on expandsocialsecurity.com that we have over 600,000 people signing on to this idea. We had Elizabeth Warren sign on recently. We had Sherrod Brown. That's kind of a testament to our success. But another testament to our success, I think one of the real indicators that this idea that Social Security shouldn't be cut, and if anything, it should be expanded, is, you know, the fire alarms that are going off on the other side by the people who like to talk about how it's in trouble.
Yeah, and the money that's going into it. I mean, you know, I look at this Fix the Debt group, I look at the Third Way, and I look at this other one, supposedly millennials who don't want Social Security. Have you seen this campaign, the Can Kicks Back?
Yeah, that's part of Fix the Debt, actually. That's their youth campaign where they get people who are hip and young to try and get other young people to be worried about the sky falling.
Yeah.
You know, you see that. You also see the Washington Post calling out bold progressives, you know, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, boldprogressives.org, for calling for expanding Social Security. And then, as you mentioned, Third Way, the Wall Street-backed think tank, putting an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, slamming Elizabeth Warren, economic populism, and expanding Social Security as, you know, not good ideas for the Democratic Party. Elizabeth Warren, Social Security, the two most popular things in the Democratic Party right now, and they're going to say, no, no, that's a bad idea.
Well,
they can tell that, you know, they're scared.
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to minimize, because I think the vast majority of people, Democrat, Republican, Independent, Martian, I don't care, most working class people are looking at Social Security going, you know, I want Social Security. I want Medicare. I want what my parents and my grandparents got. I want to be able to have that kind of security. If you remember the whole 2010 election cycle, you had people out there going, tell the government to get their hands off of my Medicare, because they like it. It works. It's good for society. It's good for the country. Yet you've got these forces, and it's generally the moneyed interests, in my view, who want to destroy it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's, you know, when you see studies come out that say, you know, all this stuff about how we need to cut Social Security, and they come from the serious people in Washington, like the Third Way and the American Enterprise Institution, but you don't really know, okay, you're saying this, but why are you saying this? And, you know, Senator Warren actually raised a really great point recently where we don't have transparency and how much Wall Street money is going to these really serious people's think tanks.
Yep.
To see, hey, you know, is Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan, are they lining your pockets? And is that the reason you're saying that Wall Street should be deregulated and, you know, we should just trust them? And I think that's something that we definitely need. We need transparency to know where these big, serious ideas that, you know, come into Washington are really coming from.
Yeah, I think we all know they're coming out of the big money think tanks. So what should the average person do? I mean, we hear so many of these messages, Matt, where you just, you know, and they sound so plausible. It's, well, you know, if we just, you know, we could fix Social Security by chain CPI. And people go, oh, okay, is that it? Because I don't think anybody knows what chain CPI is. A lot of people know what CPI is. But it sounds so easy. It sounds so simple. How do we fight back?
Well, I think Elizabeth Warren really said it best. It's just a fancy way to say cuts to benefits. I think, you know, when you talk about Social Security, you need to talk about what its purpose is and what it does for folks. Now, do you want Social Security to be there to make sure that seniors can pay for the things that they need? Do you want Social Security to be a real program they can help real people? Okay, then let's figure out how to make that happen. We shouldn't be worried about, you know, 60 years down the line because it's paid for. You know, Social Security helps people, and we should figure out how to make sure that it really helps people by expanding the benefits. You know, when people talk about what's going to happen 75 years down the road, and then you think back 75 years previous, how many of their predictions of doom and dire and, you know, crisis actually came to fruition. You know, we figure things out and things get better. Yep. We should focus on how to make Social Security help more people, expand the benefits, make it, you know, face reality of what seniors' costs are, not worry about, you know, cutting benefits now so we don't have to do the exact same thing 30 years from now. It doesn't make sense.
I'm right there with you. Matt, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues, because it's not going away, is it?
It is not going away, but we'll keep fighting, Rick.
I appreciate it. Matt Walsh, press secretary over at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
For the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized the renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
But the fact
is, Vice President Cheney, though, said it's not a Ponzi scheme. You say it is.
Absolutely. If Vice President Cheney or anyone else says that the program that we have in place today, and young people who are paying into that, expect that program to be sound and for them to receive benefits when they reach retirement age, that is just a lie. And I don't care what anyone says. We know that. The American people know that. But more importantly, those 25 and 30-year-olds know that.
Well, you know, the key in that sentence, I don't care what anyone says. I mean, that's really the most important, most telling line out of Rick Perry's mouth right there. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care. You can show me all the facts you want, you and your facts. I don't care. I have my belief. Sad, sad stuff. Interesting story I came across. You know, one of the things I focus on quite often is, you know, we use the word hero an awful lot. When people do heroic things, we put them up on a pedestal, and we give them praise, heap praise upon them, because praise doesn't cost an awful lot, does it? It doesn't cost an awful lot. Oh, you're my hero. It does cost a little bit to when the people that we call hero get sick, that we actually help take care of them. And I saw this story in the New York Daily News that looked at the responders, the Ground Zero responders after 9/11. You may remember that Congress set up a $2.8 billion compensation fund back in 2011. There's a Grota fund because it was supposed to help get people the health care that they need who had been the heroes who rushed to the burning rubble to dig through and look for survivors. If you remember the weeks and the months after 9/11, you had people down there constantly digging through asbestos and cement dust and all of this. Who knows this stew of who knows what, of human remains and diesel fuel. And you've got people who've got cancer and lung problems and breathing problems and all kinds of bizarre ailments. Well, the New York Daily News, they did a piece that said, you know, basically registering for the program, pretty simple. Receiving the benefits, not so much. And they write, advocates project that only half of the covered ailments, half of covered all ailments and will qualify. They point out more than 11,000 registrants have submitted eligibility forms, and the fund has made decisions on about 2,500 of them, deeming 871 eligible. Awards totaling $27.2 million have been pledged to 112 claimants who got decisions. Here we are. Here we are a dozen years after the fact. And there are still people who haven't gotten the health care that they've needed, the health treatment that they've needed. And they go through story after story of, you know, the more than 1,100 people who were dealing with cancer because of what they did, the hero status that we gave them 12 years ago. And here we are, not so much, not helping. And I remember Giuliani, and I remember Bush, and I remember, oh, it was photo time. Oh, we're here with the heroes. Took 10 years, took an entire decade to say that we're going to get them the health care that they need? Really? I mean, we have rebuilt Ground Zero. The Freedom Towers are up. But what about the lives of the people who, what about the lives of the people who were there that day, that for the weeks and the months after? What about those people? They're not rebuilt. Their lives are not whole. It's, well, It's sad stuff. And it's not surprising to me. And that's what really bothers me. And it's not because I'm jaded. It's not because I'm, this is the stuff that I've been saying is going on. It's easy to stand around with the photo op. It's easy to put someone on a pedestal. But boy, when it comes time to pay up, no, not so much. I look at our veterans. Look at the guys coming back from the wars of choice in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was a move by some of the unions out west to get a law passed that would, to get the Department of Labor to implement a law that would encourage building contractors, construction firms to hire disabled veterans. The Associated Builders and Contractors Group, ABC, they have filed an injunction to prevent the implementation of the new rule by the Department of Labor. They have called it wasteful and burdensome. And, you know, you look at this and you go, to understand, the ABC is a wealth class shill group. They represent less than 1% of all construction contractors. Yet you see the big signs everywhere. You want a contractor? You want their job done? You see the money that they put into promoting themselves when the reality is they're funded mostly by very well-to-do. They're funded by law firms and car dealerships and who knows what. Very few actual contractors. But what they are is vehemently opposed to any workers' rights. And pushing this idea of the independent contractor, which takes me back to last night when we were talking about Blanche Lincoln, another one of these third-way type Democrats, who said, oh, it's my business. It's my business coalition. Which basically says you have the right to be exploited and misclassified. Because you know what? You're on your own, brother. As long as my check doesn't bounce. Right, Blanche? Yeah. I'm glad there are people in the streets, man. And I'm hoping there are more. And I'm hoping that even if you're not affected by the conditions at fast food restaurants or the big box retailers, that you're going to stand with them. Because the reality is we are in this all together. We need to go back to the idea of an injury to one is an injury to all. We need to go back to the idea of all for one, one for all. I mean, you know, I remember those slogans when I was a kid, and they've been around for generations. But they still have the same meaning they did then. And if this country is going to rise, it's going to rise because of all of us. If it's going to fall, it's going to fall because we've been divided and conquered. It's that simple. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with Hour 3. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. If you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com or Stitcher on your smartphone. Right back.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Illinois will cut state worker retiree benefits, raise the retirement age for some public workers, and in some cases cut cost of living adjustments. Unions call it theft and are taking it to court because the Illinois Constitution bans diminishing or impairing state worker pensions. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said political attacks on workers' hard-earned pensions are unconscionable. She says the bill should be vetoed by Governor Pat Quinn.
Weingarten says the pensions bill in the legislature would rob working people of their life savings. Workers will get less in retirement while the state saves $90 to $100 billion over three decades. For years, politicians in Illinois shortchanged public worker pension systems by failing to put enough money in. The Illinois House earlier had refused to allow a vote on a union-backed plan to reform the pension system, even though it had passed the Illinois Senate. As the American Legislative Exchange Council met in Washington, D.C., some members of Congress sounded the alarm about the pro-corporate anti-public interest agenda of ALEC. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan says ALEC is arguably the most effective lobbying organization in the country, and in his opinion is violating IRS rules on political lobbying by 501(c) groups. While ALEC lawyers are trying to form a new front group to get around IRS political lobbying rules, Representative Pocan says ALEC continues to attack the public interest in a variety of ways.
From voter ID laws to pension law changes to going after public workers to the Stand Your Ground law and many, many other bills we've seen across the states when they're introduced in a number of places. It's from this conservative organization, this lobbying firm that's called ALEC. It is definitely not in the public interest. It's in the special interests who fund the organization, and we need to do everything we can to stop their activities.
A new report from the Center for Effective Government says lower taxes on corporations does not produce more jobs. The report says the 30 corporations that paid the highest effective tax rates added 200,000 jobs to the U.S. economy during the past 5 years, while the 30 corporations with the lowest tax rates cut 50,000 jobs during the same period. American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox says this report could fundamentally change the shape of the budget debate in Washington. Cox says America faces a jobs crisis, not a budget crisis. AFG is calling for more revenues to prevent job cuts and to provide needed services. In 2012, U.S. corporations reported earning nearly $1.8 trillion in profits. If they had paid a 35% tax rate, revenue would have been $630 billion. But they paid a much lower average of 12.6% effective tax rate instead, yielding just $242 billion in revenue. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1,000 years of darkness, yeah, when all the power's out. You know, because I love, there's a guy I run into every once in a while when I do my weekend trucking job. We go, well, the Democrats want us to live in darkness. They don't want any oil or any energy. And I'm going, no, I don't know where you're getting that from, but it's ludicrous and it's ridiculous, which is why we've spent so much money on alternative, energy, trying to become self-sufficient. Be it solar, wind, tidal, you know, geothermal, whatever. There are opportunities that we should be investing in and investing in heavily so that we become energy independent. Problem is, that kind of stuff doesn't make big corporations an awful lot of money, and they're not happy with it, which is why you're seeing this whole assault on renewable energy. But, you know, something caught my attention today because, you know, you've got the forces out there who we just need oil and gas and coal. That's all we need. We need the extraction fuels. That's what we need. That's it. We just need more. We need to drill, baby, drill. And I saw Paul LePage, the governor of Maine, had an interesting statement at Maine's transportation conference that I think got a lot of headlines. He said, everybody looks at the negative effects of global warming, but with the ice melting, the Northern Passage is opened up. So maybe instead of being at the end of the pipeline, we're now at the beginning of a new pipeline. So, you know, like Rex Tillerson said, we'll engineer our way out of it. It's an opportunity. In fact, you know, maybe we should hasten the ice melting so we can cut through there. Because evidently, the Northern Sea Route, or the Northern Passage, as he called it, is a shipping lane that connects the east coast of the U.S. to Asia. And the route is about 4,000 miles shorter than going through the Suez Canal. So, you know, you're talking a whole lot shorter of a travel distance. But the problem is, you know, up until a couple of years ago, it's only open about 2 months of the year. Now, what the reports are saying is now with the melting and it's a longer season, you're seeing much, much more ship traffic. In fact, according to the Voice of Russia, and I don't know how reliable they are, but that's the report I saw. They reported in 2011 that 85% of the ships that went through this northern sea route were carrying oil or gas. So maybe Paul's got maybe the consulate of the Soviet of the former Soviet Union, maybe the Russian consulate was visiting Paul LePage. It's like, hey, well, you keep spraying that aerosol in the air so that ice melts and we'll bring you some oil. But again, you know, it's all about the money, isn't it? We don't care about the future of the country, the future of the planet. All we care about is money. And I read another report in USA Today today, actually, that said that because of the climate change, we're seeing a wider range of diseases caused by ticks and mosquitoes because they're not dying. It's not getting cold enough in certain areas, and they're not dying off. In fact, the CDC said that there's a spread of brain-eating amoeba. Evidently, these brain-eating amoeba are showing up in northern lakes. And, you know, in the past, it was just too cold for them to exist. But now they're saying it's brain-eating amoeba. That can't be good, right? And they're saying, look, it's part of the climate change. This is part of whether it's man-made, and this isn't, you know, I don't want to get into the whole global warming is man-made, because I got to be honest, you know, from a logical standpoint, I think we have a lot to do with it. I think you do have cycles. I do think that's part of it as well. But I think, you know, when you're burning a whole ton of stuff, when you've depleted the ozone, when you've got China who's shutting schools down for days at a time because the air quality is so bad, when you see the people in China riding around with masks on their face, that's a problem. We're on one planet. This is a very small planet. So for me, this idea that we invest heavily in alternative energy is the way to go. It's a smart investment. And, you know, when I put solar panels on my house a couple years back, again, thank you. This is a big thank you to the Republican Party here in Pennsylvania. The ESSERA credit, solar renewable energy credit, was going for about $225. So, you know, the payoff of my solar panels would have been like 5 years. You know, we would have made Wall Street and the big oil and gas companies buy renewable energy to make as part of their portfolio. And, you know, people who would put them on their homes, they would reap those benefits and pay the cost of the panels off quicker. Now it's going to take me probably 15 years to pay off, just based on generation and savings from my personal use. Here in Pennsylvania, it went from $225 down to $10 a credit. And the Republicans have done nothing to fix the gap. In fact, Chris Ross, the Republican in the House, actually put forth a piece of legislation that would have fixed that, that would have made energy companies, would have made them buy these credits. And more of them, which would have raised the price of them. And the other part of this, remember, this is the party of jobs. The party of jobs, 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 right? The more jobs governor, the more jobs legislature, all of them, they're all laser-like focused jobs, 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 right? Understand, by allowing these credits to go into the pot, from $225 a credit down to $10, what you have effectively done is you have destroyed an entire industry and you have put people out of work by the thousands. Because in Pennsylvania, the solar industry is dead. Nobody's putting them on homes anymore because nobody's willing to put up a 15 or 20 year investment. When it was 5 or 6, when there was money available to make it a 5 or 6 year investment, people were willing to do it. It's good for the environment. It's good for the country. It's good for your bottom line. So what you've got is you've got these Republicans who, we're not doing anything. Heck with you. You and your solar panels. Well, that's not enough. Evidently, that wasn't enough, because now you've got Alec, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They're pimping model legislation that will penalize individual homeowners who put solar panels on their homes, and they seek to further weaken state clean energy regulations. So if here in Pennsylvania, if you had, say, you know, 5% of all the energy used in the state has to be from a renewable, and as part of their portfolio, they have to have 5% from wind, 5% from solar, whatever. Whatever the renewable portfolio standard puts them at. Well, they've let it drop, and they've let it freeze. That's not enough. What the ALEC legislation seeks to do is it seeks to make those things go away, that there are no more standards, that they don't have to buy any more renewable energy, which would completely kill the industry, what's left with it. Now, there are model bills, and this is what's come out of this week's conference of ALEC in Washington, D.C. There are model bills that are aimed at doing just that. There are modeled pieces of legislation that are aimed at blocking Obama's effort to cut greenhouse gas emission. There are tons of stuff that are saying, you know, states can't expand their wind and power, nothing. And what I found interesting is, you know, this guy John Eck, he's a legislative analyst for ALEC's Energy, Environment, and Agricultural Program. He told The Guardian that ALEC would be looking closely in the coming year at how individual homeowners with solar panels are compensated. So let's say I create a thousand kilowatts of electricity. I get one credit. And I have the ability now to sell that one credit to the energy companies. Now it's $10. So let's say I get that $10. They're going to tax me on that $10 because it's income. And I'm okay with that. What Eck and ALEC want to do, they want to now charge me, and I love this, they want to charge me for the transmission lines to get the power that I've generated back into the grid. They want to charge me a fee. Now, Arizona's already done this. Arizona is the first state to charge people with solar panels a fee to use the infrastructure. They charge them $5 a month. It's now, the industry wanted $100, but they settled for $5 because they're in the door. This is what ALEC is pushing. And I look at this stuff and I go, really? I thought you were pro-business. Now, according to the Center for Media Democracy, ALEC has sponsored at least 77 energy bills in 34 states. They did that last year. Everything from opposing renewable energy standards to pushing the Keystone XL pipeline to you know, Corbett not regulating and overseeing the drilling. But this assault on the renewable portfolio standards, a bit more for them than they could bite off. There are approximately 15 states across the country that had introduced legislation to reform or freeze or repeal their renewable mandates. Now, understand, Pennsylvania, they've frozen them already, so we're already in the books. But three states, North Carolina, Ohio, and Kansas, they saw really, really strong pushes by conservatives to reverse their clean energy regulations. Fortunately, those were pushed back upon because people in those states have seen that it actually works. But what it says to me is that the moneyed interests, they don't want solar and wind and renewable energies. And it comes back to why. You know, I said from the beginning when I put them on my house that there will be no promotion of this because there's no monthly bill that goes out. There's no way for the big multinationals to profit off of solar panels being on my house. The energy that I use, that I generate, and that I use, I don't pay anyone for. Now, look, I built the infrastructure. I put the panels. I took the expense. You know, that's not enough for them. They want that reoccurring bill. They want that money coming in every month. They want to be in our pockets all the time. Which is why we're seeing this push. Which is why we're seeing this assault. And for me, you know, the sad reality is, you know, back in the 70s when there was a push towards solar and renewable energies, they were successful. The wealth class was extremely, the big businesses, the multinationals, hugely successful at convincing us, just go back to gas. And it was another 30 years before we even started talking about renewables. My fear is we're living 1980 all over again. And the same players, the same actors, the same criminals, in my view, are the same ones who are going to screw it up for us again this time. If we let them. I mean, if we let them. Which is why we got to push back. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
In 1972, I was part of a nationwide campaign that came close to getting the U.S. Senate to reject Earl Butz, Richard Nixon's choice for Secretary of Agriculture. A coalition of grassroots farmers, consumers, and public interest organizations teamed up with progressive senators to undertake the almost impossible challenge of defeating the cabinet nominee. The 51-44 Senate vote was so close because we were able to expose Butz as, well, as Butt Ugly. We brought the abusive power of corporate agribusiness into the public consciousness for the first time. We had won a moral victory, but it turned out to be a curse and a blessing. First, the curse. Butz had risen to prominence in the world of agriculture by devoting himself to the corporate takeover of the global food economy. He openly promoted the preeminence of middlemen food manufacturers over family farmers. Agriculture is no longer a way of life, he barked. It's a business. He instructed farmers to get big or get out, and proceeded to shove tens of thousands of them out by promoting an export-based, corporate-run food economy. Adapt, he warned, or die. The ruination of farms and rural communities, Butz added, releases people to do something useful in our society. This is Jim Hightower saying, the curse of Butz, however, spun off a blessing. Small farmers and food artisans practically threw up at the resulting Twinkieization of America's food. They were sickened that nature's own contribution to human culture was being turned into another plasticized product of corporate profiteers. They threw themselves into creating and sustaining a viable alternative, linking locally with consumers, environmentalists, community activists, marketers, and others. The Good Food Rebellion has since sprouted, spread, and blossomed from coast to coast. To find farmers markets and other expressions of this movement right where you live, go to localharvest.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. I look back to a Gallup poll back from April where they found that more than three quarters of Americans polled wanted to pursue more solar energy. 71% wanted more wind power. Very few. In fact, less than half wanted more oil production, more nuclear production. There, the country kind of has spoken. We want to move in the direction of renewables. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. I've got Drew on line one, interested to talk about solar energy. Drew, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, actually, I just a couple of things that I wanted to mention on this is the electrical grid doesn't produce enough energy to power the entire United States all at once. And actually, there is a shift of the energy from the West Coast, the Central to the East Coast, because, you know, as people get up, they use more energy in the morning. So there's this shift and this change. So as a country, we don't produce enough electrical energy for all of our needs as it stands. So the introduction of solar panels will help to offset that and actually could save the power companies money if they really look into it. Because it costs a lot of money to make that shift from the West Coast to the East Coast throughout the day and then back in the evening from the East back to the West Coast.
I agree. Absolutely. And, you know, but the question then becomes, why are they opposing it? Why do organizations like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, why are they putting so much energy and effort behind ending the portfolio standards and pursuing a destruction of solar, wind, and geothermal and all the renewable energies?
Well, I mean, as long as, you know, when you look at the oil companies, you know, generally speaking, the companies themselves, there's very few of them. You know, you have OPEC, which although there's theoretically multiple different companies, they're all essentially behave as one entity.
Right, it's a monopoly.
So as long as those people have control, they're going to make the money. So they're the ones who are going to want to oppose renewable resources because that means that the oil and gas isn't going to make the money anymore.
No, I'm with you. I mean, you know, I look at this and I ask the question, you know, why is it that our legislature, I mean, I look at the polling. The polling numbers are irrefutable. Overwhelmingly, people want more renewable energy. We don't want to keep burning fossil fuels if we don't have to. I understand. We're going to continue because there's some things that maybe you can't turn around immediately. But this movement towards getting off the juice to me seems to be logical and seems to be what the vast majority of the American people want.
Well, I mean, the other thing is it's also expensive. But, so, you know, the cost has to be generally offset somewhere along the line.
But, Drew, isn't the cost of oil equally expensive? I mean, you think about the huge subsidies we give to the oil companies, the preferential treatment we give them. I mean, all of the stuff that we've handed to that industry over the last 100 years since it was founded in Titusville, Pennsylvania. I mean, you know, don't we subsidize the hell out of them?
Well, yeah. That's probably true, but the average person doesn't see it. And I think it's along those lines of, you know, out of sight, out of mind. They don't really see where that money's going. All they see is a bill that comes in the mail. It's the electric bill, and they pay it. They don't really know where that electricity is coming from. They don't really realize where that, you know, how the electricity is being generated, where their money is really going to. You know, they don't see that. And I think, and when they look at that and they go, well, I'm just paying this much on my electric bill, but if I want to invest in solar panel, I'm going to have to put all this money to put these panels on my roof. And sure, I'll be paying less than electric, but the mentality is they're not going to see that kind of savings. I mean, look, an average cost of solar panels can be upwards of $10,000.
Mine was 20. I save about 50% of my electric bill. It produces half of my family's electric. It's going to take me about 15 years to pay it off.
Right. And they actually now have, I've seen in some stores, places where they sell heating and air conditioning systems, there's a company now that's selling ones that come with a set of solar panels, but it doesn't work off a battery system. What it basically does is it loops back into your power company.
Right.
And, like, if you go on the outside of the house and you see the meter and you'll see that little disc turning, when you actually produce enough solar energy to offset the cost, it'll actually turn that meter backwards.
Yes, because I've watched it do it.
Yeah, federal law says that the power company has to pay you for any extra electricity that you generate.
Correct.
So if you generate more power than you use, you get money from the power company. So can you imagine what would happen if more people did that? Now, instead of the power company making money, now they're paying you for the energy. Now their money is going in the other direction. And I think that might be the other reason that some people are opposing it, because they don't want to see that total reversal. But
we'd be like Germany. I mean, if you look at Germany, Germany had a setup for about 10 years because they really wanted to invest in solar. They had a setup that said if you put solar panels on your house, the power company, anything in excess that you generate, the power company has to buy back at 7 times their rate. And you saw people flocking to it and putting up solar panels. And in fact, a huge portion of their electricity now comes from solar because it was a smart policy.
That's definitely the intelligent way to do it. I mean, I look at it this way. Okay, let's say the cost of panels for your installation is about $10,000. Okay, and let's say your homeowner is going to pay you about $100 a month for the power they use, plus another $100 to pay off the solar system. I know these numbers are way off. They're just a base to give you an idea.
Right.
So at the end of the first month, the homeowner has sold back to the power company $150 worth of power. The electrical bill then reflects the homeowner owes the power company no money for the power they used, $50 toward the cost of the solar system, and the cost of the solar system is now $9,950. So if you can work out a system where the generation of the power that you're using goes to pay off the system, you know, I guess that's similar to the credits.
No, we did. No, this is where the SREC credits come in, the solar renewable energy credits. Back when I bought it, the credits were $225 a piece, which my payoff time would have been about 5 years. But what's happened is you've had people like Alec and our Republican legislature here in Pennsylvania who have frozen the amount of those credits that the energy company has to purchase. So now it's such a pathetically low number, and there's so many people like me flock to it because we believe in it, one, on an ideological basis, but two, on a dollar cost average basis because it made sense. They're screwed, and they've destroyed the industry. All of those jobs that were created because they set up this system are all now lost, and because of the ALEC-type stuff, we're now in a situation where solar in Pennsylvania is dead.
Yeah, I know. That's horrible. I mean, and the thing is, though, is we haven't been investing in alternative energy research either, because there's not just solar power. There is I can't remember the name of the company, but there is a company out there, and we talk about these greenhouse gases and all this and all this exhaust from these factories and things like this. Well, they found a way to release this exhaust into, I guess it was like tubes of water, and it grew algae, and they devised a system where this growth of this algae and the use of sunlight actually produced energy. So there are other methods, you know, besides wind and solar. You know, and of course, you know, improved battery technology. And there's just, if we can sit there and we can say, you know, back when, I can't remember the years. I'm horrible with history, but, you know, we talked about let's go to the moon.
Yep.
You know, we had huge, we fired up the United States. We fired up Americans. Let's go to the moon. You know, and not only was that, you know, an incredible accomplishment, but it gave us a lot of advances in technology that helped drive, you know, drive industry.
Absolutely. So let me ask you the big question then, the million-dollar question. Is this something government should be investing in? Is this something that of an investment that we, the people, much like the space program, since you brought up the moon, is this something that we should be doing, or is this something that we should leave up to the wishes and hopes and maybe the possibilities of the private sector?
Well, see, when you think about it, you hear the term national power grid. The majority of the current power grid is already handled by government entities of some type or another, whether it's federal government or local governments. Most of them are, in fact, already handled by government entities on some level. So it would seem to me that if the government is there to serve the people, not the people to serve the government, and that the government should be thinking about what's in our best interest, then because alternative energy is going to be more cost-effective, then it seems that it would be intelligent for them to invest in more cost-effective methods to provide the American people with energy. And if you reduce the cost of energy, then you have more money in your pocket, and then you create jobs, you put more money in people's pockets, you know, and that in kind of, you know, the United States is a consumerist society. We thrive on buying crap.
Yep.
So, you know, that's what we got to do to generate. So, you know, the government, from my standpoint, is already involved in the energy business. So let's do something intelligent. Let's look at ways to cut costs. Let's look at ways to make the cost of energy less expensive.
I'm right there with you. Ever thought about running for Congress? There's a thought that, you know, because I don't hear that kind of an articulate argument coming out of Harrisburg or Washington or anywhere else. You got to think about it.
I'm in Northern Virginia, so.
There you go.
I'm not that far outside D.C., and that was actually my email that you read earlier.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, I appreciate it. And, hey, please call back anytime. It was great talking with you.
All right. Well, you have fun with the rest of your show.
Thanks so much, Drew. I appreciate it. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Illinois will cut state worker retiree benefits, raise the retirement age for some public workers, and in some cases cut cost of living adjustments. Unions call it theft and are taking it to court because the Illinois Constitution bans diminishing or impairing state worker pensions. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said political attacks on workers' hard-earned pensions are unconscionable. She says the bill should be vetoed by Governor Pat Quinn. Weingarten says the pensions bill in the legislature would rob working people of their life savings. Workers will get less in retirement while the state saves $90 to $100 billion over three decades. For years, politicians in Illinois shortchanged public worker pension systems by failing to put enough money in. The Illinois House earlier had refused to allow a vote on a union-backed plan to reform the pension system, even though it had passed the Illinois Senate. As the American Legislative Exchange Council met in Washington, D.C., some members of Congress sounded the alarm about the pro-corporate anti-public interest agenda of ALEC. Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan says ALEC is arguably the most effective lobbying organization in the country, and in his opinion is violating IRS rules on political lobbying by 501(c) groups. While ALEC lawyers are trying to form a new front group to get around IRS political lobbying rules, Representative Pocan says ALEC continues to attack the public interest in a variety of ways.
From voter ID laws to pension law changes to going after public workers to the Stand Your Ground law and many, many other bills we've seen across the states when they're introduced in a number of places. It's from this conservative organization, this lobbying firm that's called ALEC. It is definitely not in the public interest. It's in the special interests who fund the organization, and we need to do everything we can to stop their activities.
A new report from the Center for Effective Government says lower taxes on corporations does not produce more jobs. The report says the 30 corporations that paid the highest effective tax rates added 200,000 jobs to the U.S. economy during the past 5 years, while the 30 corporations with the lowest tax rates cut 50,000 jobs during the same period. American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox says this report could fundamentally change the shape of the budget debate in Washington. Cox says America faces a jobs crisis, not a budget crisis. AFG is calling for more revenues to prevent job cuts and to provide needed services. In 2012, U.S. corporations reported earning nearly $1.8 trillion in profits. If they had paid a 35% tax rate, revenue would have been $630 billion. But they paid a much lower average of 12.6% effective tax rate instead, yielding just $242 billion in revenue.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So a sad day around the world. Nelson Mandela, 95 years old, passed on today. And here to talk a little bit about that. Is William McDonald. He is with Talk Radio News Service. William, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you so much.
You know, you look at this, 95 years old, lived a long life, but, you know, one of those lives that will be long remembered.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and he may be 95, had been 95 when he passed, but he's just one of those people in world history that you just, days like this, you just don't forget.
Yeah, you know, I go back to the, I grew up during the time, the whole, we won't play South Africa, you know, all the musicians were boycotting Sun City. I remember that whole push to get to do away with apartheid, and you know, it's one of those moments in history that you go, as a globe, we were actually trying to do the right thing.
Right. Yes, you're absolutely right. And you know, during that time, during the 80s and it was a very interesting geopolitical environment. I mean, the United States and the UK were not putting sanctions on South Africa with a lot of world pressure for them to do so. And so it just shows how far we've come today that we can't imagine putting the sanctions against a regime that was controlled by, you know, a white power, a minority white power that was just criminalizing the black population. And so it's just really remarkable how far we've come, and a lot of credit is due to this great man who passed on today.
What do you think of the stories that's been banging around all day today that you know, Mandela was on the terror watch list up until 2008?
Right, yeah. On his birthday, I actually wrote up an article about that. And just, you know, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but quote, it was an embarrassment that, you know, after 18 years after his release, that he's finally removed from the terrorist watch list from the United States. And it really is an embarrassment. And that is something that needs to be reviewed maybe more closely, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm kind of an embarrassment because during the Reagan years, I would argue that they chose the wrong side in that fight.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you on that. Yes. I mean, a lot of money was made on the fact that apartheid existed, and a lot of people didn't want to lose the investment that they had that apartheid was creating. And so that made the struggle that much more difficult, but it also made the victory that much more sweet.
Yeah, and in the aftermath, how have things changed? How have things improved? What's the situation in South Africa?
So, currently, you know, in the last couple hours, I've been speaking with a lot of friends that I've made there, and I actually lived in a township for about 9 months doing research on my master's thesis. And in speaking with them, my white friends who are there, my black friends who are there, everyone has the same sentiment of this, quote, they are shattered. I've heard that expression probably four different times from a couple of different people on that they are shattered from the news. And, you know, the thing is, you know, it's a sad day, but at the same time, it's kind of interesting listening to them and talking with them that they're not just mourning, but they're also celebrating. You know, it's amazing how far that they've come and how race relations have changed. Obviously, a lot of work needs to be done. I work for Lawyers for Human Rights in South Africa doing housing inspections, and a lot of work still needs to be done. I mean, just because apartheid isn't legal doesn't mean different types of apartheid still don't exist today.
Right. Well, I mean, you could say the same thing about desegregation, you know, segregation here in the U.S. and racial relations here as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was kind of interesting. My first time there was in 2004, and it was just kind of like I stepped into America in the 1950s. Granted, I was not born then, but just from the historical lessons that I've learned, you know, that's kind of how it felt. I just felt like, you know, America has its problems, racial problems, but South Africa has so much further to come, but they have really, really done an amazing job.
Yeah, I mean, now this is a guy whose life, you know, spent fighting for racial justice, social justice, if you will. Spent how many years in prison, was it?
27.
27 years.
27 years on Robben Island. And he was working in, I can't remember the mine, but he actually had some pretty severe eye damage. And when a photograph would be taken of Mandela, they couldn't use flash because of the damages in the mine that he was working at on Robben Island. It was very extreme punishment while he was in prison.
Yeah, and it's not like sitting in jail here. They actually put you to work at the mines, right?
Yeah, and it was very hard labor. I mean, hours and hours a day, and then transported back to their tiny little cells, and it was very abusive.
And, you know, when he became president, did any of this, I mean, because he was, you know, the first democratically elected president of South Africa, right?
That's correct. Yep. I mean, lines and lines. I mean, if you go online and you Google, you know, the first election, you will see lines for miles. I mean, it really is a beautiful sight. And I remember just being touched. Even as a child, I was 13 years old, and I remember watching it on TV and just thinking, this is something really big. I think that was my first introduction of how important elections and politics really are and how important it is to pay attention.
Yeah, I mean, there are times where, you know, because I remember that period as well, and there are times I wish now that we would catch that election fever in this country and get that kind of interest in our own politics.
You know, you're right about that. And I think the thing is, I mean, we can sort of compare it to the 2008 election, where it was a real shift in the demographics, a real shift in generations who were voting. And, you know, I think we could slightly compare it to that. Obviously, it's very different. But, you know, I think that year I felt, and after having lived in South Africa for so long, that watching the people's motivation and their excitement on voting, it really comes down to American elections are the envy of the world. I really do believe that.
Yeah, and the sad reality is we've got a force in this country that's trying to turn our elections into what some of those other countries have been doing instead of the other way around.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you can't play the game, you're going to rig the game. And that is going on across states, and I'm going to say it, you know, it's just a disgrace to Mandela himself. You know, I mean, when you have these organizations and these legislators trying to stop people from voting because they know that they're going to vote a certain way, that's not democracy. That's rigging a game.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I look at, you know, all the voter suppression laws that have gone on, all of the new poll taxes that you see propping up across the country, and a lot of it comes from one central location, the American Legislative Exchange Council and the wealth class that funds that. And my fear is that someday we see some type of apartheid here in this country. You know, one of my favorite quotes that Mandela had said was, you know, something always seems impossible until it's done. Do you think his work was done?
You know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and he was a giant man, and we're going to stand on his shoulders, and we're going to remember how the inspiration that he gave to everybody. And, you know, we may become sort of, you know, passive to the things that are happening and annoyed and just kind of feeling like giving up, but at a certain point, it becomes an emotional issue. You know, people need to understand that voting and it is an emotional response, you know, that this is their civic duty. And I really do think that, you know, these loops that people are going to have to jump through to get their certain IDs, or, you know, having to vote in certain areas or no longer voting on campuses or certain things like that, that will end. I really do believe I know what you're saying, that there is a form of apartheid happening with voter suppression, and I absolutely agree with you on that. But I think, you know, to quote Martin Luther King, you know, the arc of justice bends in the right way. I really do believe that. And it takes time, and it takes, you know, some pretty hard fought battles. But I think we always come out better. We always come out better.
Yeah, I agree. And I've always agreed with the King quote that the arc of justice is long but bends towards progress. You know, and you know, hopefully that will be the In my lifetime, I'll see that. You know, but in going back to Mandela for a second, you know, we tend to, and I don't know if this is not trying to diminish what he did, but we tend to put so much stock in leaders, and not as much, in my view, as the people who, the power that he had from all of the people that were behind him. And you see the same thing with King and the same thing with others, that it was the organizations behind them. It was the work behind them of all of the people that fought for the movement as well.
Right, and you're absolutely right about that. And the thing is that we take this moment not – the real sadness that I'm feeling is, yes, of course, this great man has passed, but he was the face of the movement, and he didn't do it alone. He was not alone in this. I mean, it took – hundreds and millions of people around the world to get him to where he was in 1990 when he was freed. And I always think that, you know, it really takes an army of dedicated individuals to really, really bring to the forefront the rights that people deserve and should have.
Now, I'm with you. So let me ask you this. You know, I think everyone agrees King's vision, his dream was never fully met. I don't know that Mandela's fully met. Where next for what they stood for? Where do you see things moving forward with the vision or their work?
Well, like I said, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and I mean, that's a difficult question to ask because you never know what the future will hold,
right,
or, you know, what could happen now that he has passed on. I mean, you know, you have these ridiculous conspiracy theories about, you know, how once Mandela passes away, the country will fall. And, you know, I mean, those are ridiculous. But I really do believe that this is going to make people revisit, whether they like it or not, the struggle that it really takes. And I really do think that with his passing, that people are going to have to check themselves once again on what he's done, what the people behind him have done, and where we can go with this. You know, I mean, it really is quite remarkable how quickly from the violent 70s and 80s of the apartheid regime and the horrible human rights violations that happened. But one thing that I do want to say is that what I find most amazing about this man was that he forgave and he worked with those who imprisoned him. You know, he worked with them and he forgave them, and it just shows how strong compassion and forgiveness is so much stronger than fear or hate.
Yeah, I'm with you. But I go back to that time, and, you know, our former Vice President Dick Cheney was one of the leaders of the Republican opposition to the anti-apartheid bill, as was Ronald Reagan, the Anti-Apartheid Act. And Cheney recently said that, you know, he wasn't, you know, he didn't regret his vote.
I did not hear that. When did he say that?
According to the story I'm looking at, it was... I can't find where I just wrote.
Well, either way, I mean, let's not be too surprised from what comes out of his mouth.
Yeah, I'm not. You know, but it's one of those things that you know, you kind of go back and you remember the decisions that we made and the people that made those decisions and the power that they wielded in this country, and you know, it kind of makes you think about things.
It really does, yeah. And obviously, And a part of me, you know, when he talks about things like that, and I don't regret that decision or, you know, this decision. Does he really believe that? The only fact is that he made those decisions, he went through with them, and if he admits that they were wrong, then he goes down in history as, you know, being wrong. So I don't ever expect him to become a compassionate human being and really confess that what he did was wrong. I will never believe that he will do that.
Well, it's truly a sad day. I know 95 years old, it's a long, full life, but still, it's a sad day. William, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you. Thanks so much for your insight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Rick.
Thanks so much. William McDonald, Pentagon correspondent with Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
In 1972, I was part of a nationwide campaign that came close to getting the U.S. Senate to reject Earl Butz, Richard Nixon's choice for Secretary of Agriculture. A coalition of grassroots farmers, consumers, and public interest organizations teamed up with progressive senators to undertake the almost impossible challenge of defeating the cabinet nominee. The 51-44 Senate vote was so close because we were able to expose Butz as, well, as Butt Ugly. We brought the abusive power of corporate agribusiness into the public consciousness for the first time. We had won a moral victory, but it turned out to be a curse and a blessing. First, the curse. Butz had risen to prominence in the world of agriculture by devoting himself to the corporate takeover of the global food economy. He openly promoted the preeminence of middlemen food manufacturers over family farmers. "Agriculture is no longer a way of life," he barked. "It's a business." He instructed farmers to get big or get out, and proceeded to shove tens of thousands of them out by promoting an export-based, corporate-run food economy. "Adapt," he warned, "or die." "The ruination of farms and rural communities," Butz added, "releases people to do something useful in our society." This is Jim Hightower saying, the curse of Butz, however, spun off a blessing. Small farmers and food artisans practically threw up at the resulting Twinkieization of America's food. They were sickened that nature's own contribution to human culture was being turned into another plasticized product of corporate profiteers. They threw themselves into creating and sustaining a viable alternative, linking locally with consumers, environmentalists, community activists, marketers, and others. The Good Food Rebellion has since sprouted, spread, and blossomed from coast to coast. To find farmers markets and other expressions of this movement right where you live, go to localharvest.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
And you know, the sandwich comes at you, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Ho, 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 it's magic, you know. Never believe it's not so.
I know it's magic, yes. It's magic that some people go to jail and others do not. And I look at this story that was just sent to me. Evidently, the story broke over at the Washington Post around 8:15 this evening, so it just got to my inbox. The Washington Post reports authorities are investigating whether a veteran D.C. police officer was running a prostitution ring out of his southeastern Washington apartment. They found a 16-year-old girl who had been reported missing, according to court documents unsealed in federal court. The officer, who's been on the force for 24 years, had not been arrested as of Thursday evening, but was put on administrative leave as police continued their investigation. What investigation do you need? There is a missing 16-year-old girl. You found her in this guy's apartment with an 18-year-old girl with the smell of marijuana everywhere. The girl admitted that she was there. The girl was there to take nude photographs and be renamed to Juicy and be a prostitute. Her words. The guy was going to take her, get her hair done, get her new clothes, new shoes, rename her Juicy, and put her out on the prowl. Actually took some nude photos of her, some photos, and passed it around. She was going to be paid $80. That doesn't seem quite enough, but I guess when you're 16, it seems like a lot. The girl said that six other women worked out of the apartment were being prostituted out of the apartment, and that the advertisements were posted on the internet, which explains why when the cops went to the apartment of this guy, confiscated 9 pairs of shoes, 1 bra, 2 boxes of condoms, computers, cell phones, and a mirror. Evidently, the mirror had all the names on them. And according to the girl, the 16-year-old girl, who had been reported missing and detectives were looking for, according to her, this guy was running the prostitution ring. He has not been arrested as of this evening. Put on administrative leave. Now, let me ask you, just a quick thought. Don't you think arrested would have been, you're with a missing 16-year-old girl. If it had been you or me, locked up in a heartbeat. Now, I love what the police chief said, a woman named Kathy Lanier. She said the department is very concerned about the recent allegations of egregious conduct. She acknowledges that, it could make the police force look bad. But she said that misguided actions of a few in no way reflects on the professionalism, dedication, and integrity of the department. Now, they didn't name the guy, 47-year-old guy, in a room with a 16-year-old girl and an 18-year-old girl. 18-year-old girl, good for him, I guess. She's at least legal. A 16-year-old missing person. Now, they're not quite sure how the detectives went to this guy's house looking for the missing 16-year-old girl. But there she was. Don't you think, and maybe it's just me, don't you think that the first thing they'd have done was arrest him? Because I'll tell you, if it had been you, it would have been me, locked up. Locked up much like Henry Earl, a 64-year-old man from Lexington, Kentucky, who college students and the police and basically everybody in Lexington, I'll call him James Brown. James Brown has been arrested 1,600 times. He spent, according to the Smoking Gun, about 6,000 days in jail. And what did he do? He was drinking. He was having a good old time, being a little loud, being a little obnoxious. Got himself a drinking problem. He goes to jail. A guy with a 16-year-old girl, missing 16-year-old girl. In his apartment, possibly running a prostitution ring, he doesn't get arrested. He gets put on administrative leave and paid. That's the... Really? Mr. Earl has spent 3 of the last 5 Thanksgivings in lockup thanks to his alcoholism. Since 1992, he's been arrested more than 1,000 times. According to a spokesman for the police department, he's arrested weekly, if not 2 or 3 times a week, and sometimes 2 or 3 times a day. He's just so highly intoxicated that, according to them, he poses a danger to himself. So they lock him up. But the guy with the teenage missing girl, not so much. Wow. Oh, man. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. Stitcher on your smartphone. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'd love to hear your thoughts on not arrested, 16-year-old in your apartment, missing, not arrested. Love to hear that. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial.